meeting of Parliament, Tuesday, 5th of July. Suspension of standing orders, the Honourable the Chief Minister. Mr. Speaker, I beg to move under Standing Order 7.3 to suspend Standing Order 7.1 in order to proceed with government bills.
Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
A bill for an act to appropriate sums of money to the service of the year ending on the 31st of March 2017, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to appropriate sums of money to the service of the year ending on the 31st of March 2017 be read a first time.
I now put a question, which is that a bill for an act to appropriate sums of money to the service of the year ending on the 31st day of March 2017 be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Appropriation Act 2016.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill now be read a second time. Mr. Speaker, this is my fifth budget address this evening. It is in fact my first budget address after our re-election to government in November with great popular support, and I now have the honour to present the government's revenue and expenditure estimates for the financial year ending the 31st of March 2017. During the course of this address, I will also report to the House on the government's revenue and expenditure outturn for the financial year ended the 31st of March 2016, which was the fourth full year of a socialist liberal administration since we took office in December 2011. Mr. Speaker, it has been traditional since the first PSFP administration in 1988, when Bill Bosano was the first Chief Minister to get up and deliver a budget. This budget address will, of course, not just be my report to the House on the public finances of our nation and the state of the economy generally, but also a review of the myriad issues affecting our economic and political outlook as a nation. In fact, I have no doubt, Mr. Speaker, that this is the most important budget session of this House for a generation. Mr. Speaker, as has been the case with all my government's previous budgets, this budget is designed with prudence in mind, to support our working families above all else, to support our youth and our students, and to provide support to our senior citizens and our disabled, as well as being a budget to stimulate new business and to continue to make Gibraltar the most attractive commercial environment in the Mediterranean. At this time, it is also, of course, a budget of caution, a budget infected by necessary pause and reflection. And the fact is, Mr. Speaker, that my government has been hugely successful in the past 4 years in the management of our economy and in providing a continued level of prosperity to all sectors of our community. During our last term of office, Gibraltar has experienced average economic growth of over 10% per annum. The government has had record levels of annual recurrent budget surpluses. There have also been a significant increase in our employment levels, and the government has delivered an overall reduction in the cost of doing business in Gibraltar. The government has provided support for our working families with income tax levels already being abolished for those with income levels below £11,000. We have given back to the lowest paid in our community by not taxing them at all. There has been a significant reduction in income tax across the board for all taxpayers, and many of our working families have benefited from an increase in the national minimum wage of over 15% during our first term of office. A GSP government introduced the minimum wage in 1988 for the first time. And now, a GSP Liberal administration has continued the work of raising the minimum remuneration payable in our society in order to spread the wealth towards those most deserving. Our public servants have also benefited, with public sector pay increasing annually by well over inflation in the whole of the first 4 years we have been in government, although in the United Kingdom, with whom our public sector enjoys parity, salaries have been frozen or subject to increases of just 1%. That means that public sector salaries have increased by 14.3% over the past 4 years, whilst at the same time inflation has risen by 5.65%. That is a record of investment in the human capital of the public sector, which this GSLP Liberal administration is proud, despite the criticism we have received from inside and out of this House, to have delivered. our senior citizens, have shared in our nation's economic success with annual increases in old age pensions and in respect of the minimum income guarantee. Also, in order to provide our pensioners with the peace of mind that their dependents are well catered for, the government took the decision to reintroduce the widows and orphans pension scheme. The relevant bill is pending reading in this House later and discussion. Pensioners have also been able to continue to enjoy above market interest rates on their savings, with the continued availability of prime interest monthly income government guaranteed pension interventions issued by the Gibraltar Savings Bank. Mr. Speaker, it is no minor boast to say that Gibraltar pensioners, even the worst off, are undoubtedly better off than pensioners in most of the rest of Europe. And this should be something that people here should not take for granted. Even in respect of the household cost allowance paid not by the government, but by the independent charity community care, the government's donation of the retirement services to them in the past 3 years has insulated them from any concerns they may have had of their ability to pay the allowance in the remaining years. We have backed our pensioners by insulating them from market forces, also and thereby eliminating the worry of diminishing returns on their savings. In this respect, the spread in relation to interest rates offered by the savings bank has got wider as Bank of England's interest rates have gone down further and further. Mr. Speaker, support for our youth has included increased levels of scholarship grants for all our university students, an increase in the number of teachers in our schools, and increased levels of investment in school infrastructure. We have also invested in our hugely successful future job strategy, which has taken so many out of unemployment and given them worthwhile, meaningful jobs. We have worked to give more to our youth today, but they will be the custodians of our tomorrow. And we have invested in our community and nation as a whole in infrastructure and in the fabric of our tangible assets. Mr. Speaker, we have developed new leisure areas which have been designed also to tangentially deliver huge potential business benefits. One such area is the small boat arena, which is also a fantastic super yacht berth in the centre of our city and which is already attracting new businesses to go for the significant serving fees as well as increased bunking and other spending from these luxury vessels. The fact is that this new natural infrastructure asset also produces a magnificent leisure facility for 700 long abandoned small boat owners and their whole to the whole of the community's gain. As with the investments we have made in the refurbishment and cladding of our aging housing stock, which has made the value of those previously depreciating assets grow magnificently, and for reasons I will explore later, to the benefit of the whole of our nation, not just the people living in those estates. There have also been significant increases in income tax allowances for our disabled, as well as reductions in import duties and goods used by our disabled community, because we believe in helping the disabled, not just with handouts, but also with incentives, and we have grown in-work allowances, which have been frozen for years. We have been criticised for spending money in the future, but I am proud to have spent on our civil servants and public servants, and it is right to tax the lowest paid less. I am proud to have spent to help our pensioners and our disabled, and it is right to have raised the minimum wage as we have. And I am proud to have invested in our youth. Those who criticise our spending must also conversely and perversely be saying that they would not have spent on our civil servants or reduced taxation for the less well paid, that they would not have raised the minimum wage or helped our pensioners and our disabled as we have, and they would not have invested in our youth as we have. But as has been the case since the arriving government, Mr. Speaker, this is a project first and foremost for workers and for entrepreneurs, for those who put out their hands to work and not to take. For they are the engines on which our economy prospers and thrives, and they are the ones who will most feel now. In corporate terms, this will be a budget designed to encourage business, in particular those who might set up or establish themselves in Gibraltar after today. And it is a budget also, of course, to continue to improve our public services and to deliver sustainable growth in our economy. Mr. Speaker, in short, this budget reflects my government's ongoing commitment and mission to improve the quality of life and standard of living of all our citizens whilst carefully calibrating our response to the seismic events of the last 10 days. This year, in particular, I will have a chance today to update the House on the continuing developments arising in the aftermath of the decision of the British people in the referendum and continued membership of the European Union. In fact, this year, perhaps more than ever, this will be very much more just than a speech on the second reading of the Appropriation Bill, but the wholesale review of this state of our nation. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, I sincerely believe this is probably the most challenging budget at least since the financial crisis of 2008. as Mr. McDonnell said himself at the recent question time in this House, the Brexit decision could unleash economic effects not seen since the 1930s. This is clearly a material and adverse change to the circumstances that we face as a nation and presents a situation that we will grow with caution, prudence, and continued investment in the right areas. With that in mind, I will also, of course, in the closing aspects of my address, outline the budget measures that the government will introduce further to our manifesto commitments in response to the recent turmoil we have witnessed in the financial market, in preparation for the potential for a withdrawal of the United Kingdom from the European Union, and in order to continue to address the social and business needs of our community. Mr. Speaker, before I launch into the substance of my address, I want to thank the clerk of the House and his staff for the huge amount of work they have undertaken since the last public debate. In that time, we have held a general election, which of course meant that the House had to engage in finalising the new register of electors and the organisation of the election. Shortly after that process was over, without time to pause for breath, we embarked on the work of the vote of inclusion in the European Union referendum, which has required a new register to be compiled by the House based on different eligibility rules. If I may say so, one silver lining of the past weeks has been to see how the clerk has done Gibraltar proud in the organisation and delivery of the referendum. We have flawlessly formed part of the vote in the United Kingdom by being the first to declare our resounding verdict of 96% in favour of remaining in the European Union. We were able to highlight the strength of feeling in Gibraltar to the whole of the United Kingdom, to Europe, and to the world. I extend my hearty congratulations, and no doubt those of all members, to all the staff of the House, and to those who have conducted to assist the clerk in his capacity as the counting or returning officer for the vote. Mr. Speaker, my congratulations, however, do not extend to the rest of the British people, who I believe have made a historic error of judgment in voting to leave the European Union, although I sincerely hope that in Brexit proceedings they will prove me wrong. Pathology, Mr. Speaker, is not my strong suit, and I do not think that there is any great value in carrying out a post-mortem of the results. In fact, political commentators are doing that already round the clock in narrating to us the so popular that the Westminster Village has descended into in the past 2 weeks. But it is important to make an assessment of the current situation and to try to make sense of what has come to pass and why. Mr. Speaker, the result of the vote in England and Wales seems to have been driven not by an understanding of the European Union and a desire to leave it. More likely, Mr. Speaker, it was driven by ignorance of the truth about the European Union, by a desire to vote against the UK's establishment and government for reasons unrelated to the European Union, and perhaps more importantly, based on claims that were exaggerations of the truth coupled with absolute untruth. As I told those gathered for the annual dinner of the Federation of Small Businesses, I believe that the United Kingdom was sold Brexit on a false perspective. I believe that many of those who argued to leave lied to the British public, and I believe that their exaggerations and hyperbole and are coming back to haunt them as they stare into the vacuum about our plans for the future. Mr. Speaker, perhaps there was also exaggeration in some parts of the campaign in the United Kingdom on the side of Remain. I do not accept for 1 minute that this was the case in Gibraltar, but it was clear to me that the false Brexit perspective, if it were the perspective for a financial product regulated by the Financial Services Commission or the Financial Conduct Authority in the United Kingdom, would have led to prosecutions today. It is not an exaggeration to say that the United Kingdom has never faced such an absence of leadership as it faces today, and that, of course, that can have repercussions for us in Gibraltar. The Dutch Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, said last week that Britain is in chaos after the Brexit vote, in words which will sting all of us who have long seen the United Kingdom as a bastion of stability and in an unstable world. Mr. Rutte said, and I quote, "England has collapsed politically, monetarily, constitutionally, and economically." Mr. Speaker, who could have imagined those words uttered about our beloved United Kingdom, or at least England, 2 weeks ago? The Governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, has warned that the United Kingdom is suffering economic post-traumatic stress, and has said that the Bank of England will take whatever action is needed to support growth. Headlines in the Financial Times include a piece by Philip Stevens titled, "Britain is starting to imitate Greece." This was unthinkable to reach this end. And this is a contagion which will not be limited to the United Kingdom. The European Central Bank Chief Mario Draghi told leaders that the impact of Brexit could save a cumulative 0.3 to 0.5 percentage points of growth in the Eurozone economies over the next 2 years. Honourable members, like all the public in Gibraltar, will be closely following developments in the United Kingdom. In both the main parties and Westminster, developments seem to be proceeding at a faster pace than even social media and the 24-hour news cycle can manage. Could it be, Mr. Speaker, that human action has for once even overtaken the speed at which electronic communications can stay abreast of development? I will not be commenting at all on the party political activity at Westminster, riveting though it may be for those of us with an unhealthy interest in politics. But I will say this, I do wish for the United Kingdom as soon as possible strong and determined leadership in both principal parties. This is a time for leadership to make determined direction. In Gibraltar, Mr. Speaker, there is strong leadership, and we are united as a community and as a political class. We have spoken as clearly as ever in the result of the referendum. The people of Gibraltar have expressed their desire to remain part of the European Union and the single market with the same fervent desire as we have previously and repeatedly expressed our desire to remain British. There are many permutations that may eventually provide the mechanism for us to enjoy the type of relationship that the people of Gibraltar wish to have with the EU. I have no doubt that the United Kingdom will seek to be a facilitator of any such arrangement as we may wish and as we may be able to negotiate it. I also believe that we have strong allies in the UK in both the Remain and Leave camps who wish to help Gibraltar through this period. The fact is that we also have a common purpose with those of other nations and regions in the United Kingdom who have voted to remain in the EU. Honourable members are aware of the progress of these discussions. I expect to be in a position to confidentially brief them again shortly on development, and will of course make such timely public statements in this House or outside it as may be appropriate. There are other developments in hand, of course. What I want to stress to the whole nation, Mr. Speaker, is that the final shape of what will be our membership or association with the European Union is not yet clear. The future shape of government in Westminster, the spontaneous and huge demonstrations in favour of remaining in the EU, and the demographic analysis of the vote suggest that each day the majority moves more and more in favour of remaining. And this means it would be foolish to think that the future is determinable in any analytically reliable way. It cannot be clear until many legal and political issues have been determined. One issue which is becoming prominent is whether a notice under Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty can be given by a Prime Minister in exercise of the royal prerogative, or the vote of the House of Commons is required to trigger such a notice, which would undo the European Communities Act of 1972. A legal action appears to have commenced already in this respect. Mr. Speaker, we cannot therefore at this stage commit to any recast post-Brexit political or economic model until there is greater clarity. The leadership election in the Conservative Party presents so many permutations on its own that there are many options and alternatives to take. Already, we can see the beginning of economic policy for post-Brexit presentation shape. The Chancellor, George Osborne, said that the United Kingdom is open for business in his FCP yesterday, targeting a low rate of 15% for UK corporation tax. One might be forgiven for seeing in that approach much of what we have already been in position. That is to say, low tax, best practice, agility in the context of a very competitive business environment guaranteed by the rule of law and the flexibility of the common law. We are well placed on that roadmap and can adapt well to it if it progresses. The Sunday Times is not far off in its proposed blueprint for Britain, but that analysis of the profound implications for Britain's political and business establishment suggests that the UK has entered a different world with new challenges, but also new opportunities, where it is essential to respond robustly to the challenges and seize the opportunities. That proposal suggests a 10% corporate rate of tax to be fixed as part of the enterprise agenda for Britain, with a scheme to reward private firms for getting young people into work, which is not too dissimilar to the future job strategy. These proposed models are interesting in being so close to our own current economic model, and we must watch to ensure that we remain competitive as against the United Kingdom itself. What is absolutely certain is that in order to emerge politically stronger and economically more competitive, out of this process, we need to keep both united and very alert to all possible permutations facing us. We need to consider now as a proud nation that has come of age, and not as a colony or overseas territory of a metropolis that is told what is good for it and has to run for it. After meeting the Minister for Europe last week, I have now received the British government's assurances in writing that we will be fully involved in the process that is getting underway in the UK, and I have no doubt that we will be working in partnership with colleagues in London, leveraging off the relationships we have already invested in and built in finding the best possible way forward to Gibraltar. I also have no doubt that the European Union will welcome the fact that the people of Gibraltar voted so overwhelmingly to remain in the EU and the civil market. I have no doubt either that the most magnificent weapon in my arsenal today is that huge show of support for the pro-EU option on the ballot that we have to reach today. The fact is, Mr. Speaker, that Gibraltar has spoken clearly and with one voice, that we are not ready to say goodbye to Europe. We are not ready to leave Europe behind, and we are not ready to turn our backs on the single market. We remain a cosmopolitan Mediterranean business hub that is happily multifaceted, multicultural, and multi-ethnic. We are a people who are not only open to immigration, we are positively open and reliant upon it, given that almost half of the working population of our nation commute in every single day. All of those EU workers amongst us who were welcome before the 23rd of June remain welcome today, and they will remain welcome tomorrow. They are a huge and tremendously valued part of our success. And Mr. Speaker, we are definitely not ready to see Gibraltar lose the benefits it can leverage as an efficient and commercially attractive gateway to Europe. And this is not just an issue for us, but also, of course, for those who surround us and who support us with their labour and are part of our success. As the recent report of the Chamber of Commerce suggested, direct, registered, cross-frontier workers can amount to over 12,000, of which 7,000 are Spaniards. Gibraltar imports almost £350 million, around €420 million a year from the country, and securing thousands of additional jobs in the region. And we contribute almost 25% of the country's GDP, amounting to almost £847 million, or over €1 billion. I have met already with the mayor of Valencia, Juan Franco, and the Spanish Union, Comisiones Obreras and UGT, as they are concerned about the effect that the Brexit decision could potentially have on their members who are employed in Gibraltar or in industries in the region that are reliant on Gibraltar. I've been happy to confirm to them that the government of Gibraltar will not create any obstacles to the free movement of workers coming across our frontier. We are entirely clear about that. But what I have also told them, Mr. Speaker, is that if the price of continued access to the EU or the single market, or the price of free movement, is joint sovereignty with Spain, or indeed any other Spanish sovereignty price, then the people of Gibraltar will not pay it. It must therefore be clear to the world that the threat to cross-frontier Spanish workforce is not being made by Gibraltar, by the United Kingdom, or by the European Union. The only threat to cross-frontier workers comes from the current Spanish administration. It must be clear to everyone it is in this way that the current Spanish administration are the only ones who are creating uncertainty for frontier workers. As ever, with our Spanish counterparts, we must hope for the best and prepare for the worst. The government's view is that EU nationals are entitled to expect from Spain and hold Spain to a practical, workable, and 21st century approach. We cannot make it easy for Spain to act in an unconscionable manner on the basis that the only EU treaties create rights or indeed demand a civilized and sensible arrangement between neighbours. It will not be lost among our members that we enjoyed the free passage of people, including workers and free trade, for many years before a now long deceased and not missed dictator first imposed conditions and then closed the frontier in 1969. We must still not be expected to accept as Spanish default position the regime suffered under Western Europe's last post-war dictator. And I therefore call on all in our community to meet this challenge with our usual resolve, and also with a renewed commitment to promoting, serving, and working for Gibraltar. More than ever before, this is a time to believe in ourselves, a time to trust the political leadership of the community, which will reach out to work with the whole nation, a time not to fear the unknown, but to seize the opportunity to shape our future in our own fashion. For many years, Gibraltar PLC has given and all have taken. It is now also time for us to give back more than we take. It is time to build on the solid foundations we have laid by our prudent investment in our nation. It is time to further solidify our already strong foundations even more. Unity in the months and perhaps years ahead does not only mean trying to align and agree our political priorities. It also means all of us working together to develop and grow our economy. We provide services to an international clientele. Every interaction with our clients, investors, and visitors is an opportunity and a responsibility. We can and must make all the difference. In that respect, the public service will be hugely important. Every civil servant, every public servant must be aligned to the need to ensure that Gibraltar is now seen as more efficient than other places, an easy jurisdiction in which to do business. No one can say or think it is acceptable to simply take the computer says no emphasis to the public ever again. We have no easy ride from here on in. We have to be ready to do more, to go further, to work harder, to be more efficient, and to yield greater influence than ever in building our common future in order to ensure we stay relevant, competitive, and growing. The civil service has never let Gibraltar down before. I am sure it will not do so now, and we will be ready to meet the challenge that will come as we send out the message that we are open for business as usual, we are open for business with Europe, and we are open for business with the world. Mr. Speaker, in this respect, honourable members will be pleased to hear that the state of private sector projects in Gibraltar remains healthy despite the Brexit result. We are about to see the finalisation of negotiations for the commencement of major new reclamation projects in the area of Coaling Island. Land reclamation needs to continue now perhaps more than ever, so that we can ensure that businesses can have their workers safe here and not dependent on the ability to commute easily into Gibraltar. A number of projects to allow for gaming and financial services workers to be housed in Gibraltar and new key worker housing firms have been proposed to the government and are under active consideration. Our community needs to understand that we need to build more and build higher in order to house those that we need to have in Gibraltar if we are going to maintain our standards of living for future generations. And in that context, Mr. Speaker, we are continuing our negotiations in respect of the plot of Rook, which we expect will be handed over very shortly to the government by the MOD. I expect to hold meetings with the preferred bidder in respect of that exciting potential development in September. Negotiations in respect of the East Side project are also continuing, unaffected by the Brexit result, but hampered by complex discussion and engineering concerns. A new project is being considered and proposed, on which I would expect to make announcements soon, and which will bolster economic activity in coming financial years. World Trade Center, Ocean Spa Plaza, Midtown 1 and 2 are already underway. The new King's Wharf development of £60 million and EuroCity are about to get underway and are also confirmed despite Brexit, amongst others, soon to be announced. Mr. Speaker, the government has already done considerable work to attract businesses to Gibraltar that are not dependent on our access to the EU. More details of these businesses will emerge as further progress is made on the relevant projects being undertaken. In this respect, the work we have done in the United States and in the Far East, in particular by agents including Hong Kong, is now expected to become even more relevant. The Gibraltar US and CAN and the Gibraltar Israel Chamber of Commerce are clearly even more welcome than they ever were before. In order to make Gibraltar even more attractive for private sector investment, I have asked the Minister for Financial Services to reconvene the working group that is also in the proposed new mechanisms for categories and status, and to also urge the progress we're working on the taking on tax schools. The Speaker is worth noting that Monaco, to which we are so often compared and is such a success, is not in the EU. The competitive tender process for onshore storage of bunkers will continue unaffected by the Brexit result, as the parties that attended have expressed a desire to continue in the process despite the referendum. This will be hugely beneficial for the future of our bunkering industry and will be alongside the potential for expanding LNG bunkering in the bay. In the insurance industry, a leading practitioner of the sector has written that Brexit does not represent doom and gloom for the proposed insurance industry. Far from it, it simply means that the sector needs to partially reposition itself, end quote. In respect of online gaming, a number of companies have already confirmed continued support and commitment to the jurisdiction for the long term and are voting with their leases to demonstrate it. William Hill, Rutherland, and others have already made clear statements of continued commitment. bulk of his address. But one specific example was a statement from Ed Ware, the chief executive officer of 32 Red PLC, who said this week that 32 Red, and this is a quote, was born and bred in Gibraltar, and it is very much business as usual. We have a strong relationship with Gibraltar on many fronts, and we are heartened that the jurisdiction gave every sign of continuing to progress and develop despite the surprise results of Indian Gibraltar. Gibraltar is a center of excellence for donors, and we remain committed to working towards another 40 years of great success here. Mr. Speaker, this is language that the whole House is about to hear, and I thank Mr. Ware for those heartfelt words. Mr. Speaker, our economic performance is an important part of what makes us attractive to international businesses. It is therefore important that we should now undertake a substantive analysis of our economy and public finances by carrying out a detailed understanding of the global economic performance in the past financial year, ending on the 31st of March 2015. Indeed, without anyone being in any way fancy, I am sure that all honourable members and the whole community will be pleased, reassured and heartened by the excellent performance of the Gibraltar economy in the past 12 months of the financial year 2015-16, although this positive performance does not ameliorate the potential challenges that Europe and the world will no doubt face in the coming 24 months and for which we will have to prepare. Mr. Speaker, inflation in Gibraltar averaged 0.3% in 2015 compared to 1.8% in 2014. Annual inflation stood at 0.4% in April 2016, up to 0.1% in January, an average of 0.3% for the first 2 quarters. The largest contribution to the slowdown in the rate of inflation in April 2015 came from static or falling prices in respect of food, alcohol and drinks, tobacco, fuel prices and slower price rises in clothing and footwear. The government statistics office reports that these were partially offset by upward contributions from other salaries and transport, services and housing. Gibraltar's rate of inflation was averaged at 0.25 in 2016, lower than the same period in 2015 that averaged at 0.5. Weak inflation has been caused by low fuel prices from downward inflation pressures in the UK and Spain, and from which we import most of our non-fuel commercial goods. The rate of inflation is predicted by a statistics office to rise in the second half of 2016, following the increase in global oil prices that have nearly doubled since hitting 13-year lows earlier in 2016. This may, however, now not materialise as a result of the impact of the result of the EU referendum, which may produce effects that cycle forth generally, particularly in the areas which I have outlined, and have already slowed and may now not have as expected. The falling value of the pound may nonetheless compensate for wholesale imports forced to euros or dollars or other foreign currencies, makes them more expensive to consumers at the point of retail. Mr. Speaker, I turn now to an analysis of the gross domestic product and of average national income. The final GDP estimate for 2013-14 is now confirmed at £1.48 billion. That represents a growth in nominal terms of 12.3% or £161.56 million, and in real terms of 10.3% over the previous year's final GDP estimate of £1.32 billion. The GDP preliminary estimate for 2014-15 is confirmed at £1.64 billion. This provides an increase of 10.7% in nominal terms, or £158.93 million, and by 10.6% in real terms over the previous financial year. Honourable members will recall that happily, this exceeded our own initial estimate of where Gibraltar's GDP would be in 2014-15, as we had anticipated that the GDP of Gibraltar would have reached £1.65 billion only a year later in financial year 15-16. Mr. Speaker, that means that in the four financial years from 2011-12 to 2014-15, the gross domestic product of our nation rose by 49%, from £1.1 billion to £1.64 billion. I think, Mr. Speaker, that everyone in our community and our cross-sector workers should be congratulated for having achieved that remarkable growth. Yet it is important to now factor in also the growth that we have seen in the financial year since then, as the preliminary GDP forecast for 2015-16 is now estimated to be £1.77 billion. This, Mr. Speaker, is an increase of 8% in nominal terms, or $134.5 million, and 7.5% in real terms compared to the previous year. If I may say so, Mr. Speaker, it is exactly in keeping with the estimates we made at the time of the general election, and once again predicted the growth we anticipated was possible. In terms of the period since 2011-12, Mr. Speaker, the cumulative growth achieved from a final GDP estimate then of 1.1 billion to the preliminary GDP forecast now in 2015-16 is of an absolutely remarkable 61% for those five financial years. Mr. Speaker, the nation deserves to congratulate itself for having achieved this really quite unprecedented growth in the period. The average increase in GDP in the period is 12.2% per year, which really demonstrates just how effectively we have been able to channel the energy, the enthusiasm, and the work of this community in this five-year period. Mr. Speaker, the government is now working towards a target that will see increases in GDP to at least $2.4 billion by the end of March 2020. This represents a continued average annual growth of around 7.5% and is the basis of the program on which we have been elected. Mr. Speaker, despite the Brexit rate in the referendum, we are confident that this rate of GDP growth continues to be today entirely achievable, and we will work to deliver that level of growth in the coming months and years. While analyzing GDP, the particular division of GDP on a per capita basis of an economy is often used as an indicator of the average standard of living of individuals in that country. As a result, the growth in the overall size of the economy is therefore often seen as indicating an increase in the average standard of living. As I said before in earlier speeches, my own view is that these measures are not entirely scientific because of the differing methodologies and fluctuating exchanges on which they are based. Nonetheless, they are the measures that the rest of the world relies on. Nominal GDP per capita in 2014-15 was £50,941. The latest forecast for 2015-16 estimates a nominal GDP per capita growth of 7.9% to £54,979. On the IMF GDP per capita ranking, the UK features in 28th position with a GDP per capita of $41,159, and Spain in 36th position with a GDP per capita of $34,819. Gibraltar's GDP per capita for 2015-16 is forecast at $90,165, placing Gibraltar in 4th position, down one, in the table. Third place has been taken by a new entry, the Macau Special Administrative Region of China, which is new to the list of the third position with a GDP per capita of $98,135. And that raises up to speak even in fourth position ahead of Singapore on $85,253, Britain, Hong Kong, the UK, and Spain. As if to demonstrate how fluctuating and thereby potentially meaningless the calculation is, the figures would, of course, vary widely depending on what day, indeed, what hour of the last week one might have carried out the calculation because of a steep fluctuation in the value of sterling against the dollar. The important aspect of this exercise is really only to appreciate that the global economy is estimated to have grown in real terms by 7.5% in 2015-16, with average earnings going up by 7.9%. This place places us ahead of other small countries, including Malta, Luxembourg, Singapore, and Hong Kong. Mr. Speaker, the level of aggregate public debt as of the 31st of March 2016 was marginally lower than last year at £446 million, and the level of cash reserves ended the financial year at around £100 million. This reflects net public debt at £345 million, or 19% of GDP. We had expected that the net public debt would be down already to 19% of GDP, or £314 million. The delay in finalizing the negotiations in respect of the sales and land, which has produced large premiums, have meant that the net debt has not been reduced by these funds. We are nonetheless confident both that the negotiations for the relevant development projects will be finalized, and I will be saying more in this respect later. And we are also very confident indeed that we will be able to hit the debt target set out in our manifesto, so that net debt will be £300 million by the end of the financial year 2019-20, which will by then be 12.5% of the GDP at 2.4 billion. Gross public debt remains unchanged, and the reduced level of aggregate public debt reflects the balance held by the generation of the economy. Mr. Speaker, liquid reserves held by the government ended the year marginally higher than the cash reserve, as it was established practice to full breakdown of these liquid reserves and detail as to where these reserves are investing with the providers as part of the annual account of the government once these are audited by the principal auditor. Mr. Speaker, given that at the same time the GDP has grown, the public debt has fallen, the Gibraltar public debt to GDP ratio has fallen in aggregate terms by 2.1%. From 27.3% in 2014-15 to 25.2% in 2015-16, according to the GDP forecast. In net terms, the public debt represents 19.5% of GDP in 2015-16, a decrease of 3.4 percentage points compared to 2014-15, when it stood at 22.9%. These ratios continue at considerably lower rates than those of the UK and most other European countries. According to figures provided by Eurostat, the United Kingdom has a debt-to-GDP ratio of 89.2%. The lowest figure for the UK in recent memory was 31% in the early 90s. Germany has a rate of 71.2%, with its lowest figure of 54% coming from the days when the process of German reunification was started. For the Euro area as a whole, the ratio is 90%, and for our neighbour, Spain, the rate is 99.2%, well below the Greek 175% and the Japanese 292%. But Mr. Speaker, although we're doing remarkably well in respect of the ratio of GDP to debt, we are not complacent in this respect, and we are aiming to ensure that we hit our own target of 300 million of net debt on a GDP of 2.4 billion, a ratio of 12.5% by the end of the financial year 2019-20. As we are faced by the uncertainty of the Brexit decision in the EU agenda, we must be more cautious in spending, more prudent in saving, and more acute in achieving the previous ratio, something which we are as committed to doing today as we were when we fought the general election in November. Our overall borrowing is relatively low, even if we were to include the borrowing by government and companies, which, as honourable members know, is not and has never been deemed to be part of the public debt. This is so because borrowing by government and companies is serviced directly from the income accruing to these companies and is secured against income generating assets held by those companies and not against the consolidated fund or the general revenues of the government, and has been the case under successive administrations. Mr. Speaker, the government nonetheless remains committed to reducing its debt servicing costs and is fully engaged in restructuring its borrowing in order to take advantage of the historically low levels of market interest rates. In this respect, and as part of ongoing management of the public debt, opportunities to extend the maturity profile of the public debt are also being actively looked into by the Ministry of Finance. Mr. Speaker, honourable members will see that the estimated surplus for this financial year set out in the estimate book was £18 million. That estimate was, of course, as ever, a conservative estimate of what we believe was achievable. Mr. Speaker, I'm delighted to announce to the House and to the nation that during the last financial year, 2015-16, we have once again exceeded our estimates for the fourth consecutive year and achieved a recurrent budget surplus which is amongst the highest ever on record at £38.8 million. I'm surprised I'm not speaking. This is more than double the originally estimated surplus for the year and produces the third highest surplus in our nation's history. In addition, Mr. Speaker, it is worth noting that the surplus of £38.8 million is declared after the deduction of £25 million to fund the government company, funding which was not done by the previous administration, which preferred to accumulate losses in the company. We moved away from that way of doing things in our first financial year in office and have consistently deducted £25 million to fund company losses in each year since our first election and declared record surpluses. In this instance, for the sake of comparison of life with life, I should clarify that if we were declaring a surplus in the same manner as the former administration, which members of the party obviously represent, we would have been declaring today, Mr. Speaker, a surplus of £63.8 million, which would be the highest on record for our nation. But we continue to believe it is more prudent and appropriate, as we set out to do from the minute we were elected in 2011, to make the deduction in order to fund company losses, as I have stated. Mr. Speaker, this year's surplus arises from government revenue during the last financial year, exceeding the original budget of around £22 million. As a reflection of the continuing growth in our economy, income tax receipts were up by around £5 million, and company tax receipts were up by over £20 million. The House will be pleased to note that despite the deficit for the conference fund quarters, departmental expenditure during the year, on the other hand, has been contained by the government, and ended this financial year broadly in line with the original budget. Mr. Speaker, I want to congratulate all controlling officers for their financial management and effectively returns, although some departments where costs were demanded have exceeded their budget for that reason. Indeed, this result is no doubt greatly aided by the measures introduced by the government to control unnecessary expenditure being incurred in the final quarter of the financial year. Mr. Speaker, moving on now to community affairs. As in previous budgets, and in line with our manifesto commitments to help the Broader Community Affairs Trust build up its reserves so it can become totally independent of government grants, I am delighted to inform the House that a further fund of £20 million has been earmarked by the government this year as a contribution to the charity. This contribution will be paid out from the government's recurring surplus for the year. Community care no longer needs the whole of the government surplus, and for that reason, we are fixing the amount to be donated to the charity to part of this year's record-breaking amount. By the donation of this amount, community care will be on track to have reserves of £230 million by 2019-20, as we were committed to this year. Mr. Speaker, I now move on to the revenue and expenditure budget for the current financial year. Estimated recurrent revenue for the year is budgeted at £590 million. This represents an increase in revenue of over £30 million, or 5.5% over the previous year. But is nonetheless a conservative budget going forward. The overall recurrent expenditure budget for the year is £570 million, which reflects a modest increase of around 5% over the 2015-16 budget. Mr. Speaker, this would represent expenditure at 32% of GDP. A similar comparison for the United Kingdom, Spain, and Germany would be in the region of 43 or 44%, France is at 57%, and the euro area as a whole at 48%. Because the government is therefore conservatively projecting a recurrent budget surplus for this financial year of around £20 million. This year we continue to think it is right to project conservatively that such a surplus rather than overestimate and find that we are unable to meet targets. In these times, prudence will prevail in making this estimate as it has in every other year since our election. Mr. Speaker, during the last financial year, 2015-16, the government invested around £99 million in capital projects funded from the Improvement and Development Fund. Around £80 million was invested in works and equipment, and a further £81 million was invested in specific capital projects. This includes an investment of £12.2 million to complete the new 700-berth small boat marina, the provision of equity funding of £15.9 million from Gibraltar International Bank, and £6.7 million of equity funding for the University of Gibraltar. All of these are excellent programs that have added greatly to our growth as a nation. Mr. Speaker, there were also further capital projects funded through the government and company. These include the construction of over 1,000 new affordable homes and rental homes, and the construction of car parking facilities in numerous locations around Gibraltar. Mr. Speaker, the expenditure budget of the Improvement and Development Fund for the current financial year 2016-17 is reduced by a third to a more modest £61 million approximately in this year's estimate. The capital investment in work and equipment is estimated at around £20 million, and the provision for investment in other government projects amounts to £41 million. This fund includes further equity funding of £3.2 million for the University of Gibraltar, an investment of £4.9 million on our roads and parking projects, over 11 million for the reclamation of a larger number, relocation, sorry, of a larger number of MOD estates agreed by the former administration in order to enable the continued release by the MOD of further land and properties for use by our community. 3.1 million for completion of the conversion and refurbishment work of the old Naval Hospital. 1.3 million for infrastructure work required for the new power station. 1.9 million for infrastructure work for new housing projects. 1.2 million to complete the St. Bernard Casing facility. 1.2 million for general improvement to housing estates and further provisions to complete other ongoing capital projects. Nominal amounts are provided in respect to some of the more exciting projects and developments we would like to see materialized, but which are still undergoing the detailed planning stages. All of these, Mr. Speaker, are important investments in our future. The government will nonetheless be keeping a close watch on expenditure and political developments, and will, if necessary, have to make the decision to rein in expenditure further and not incur costs in the project if the circumstances so require. Mr. Speaker, I am delighted to report to the House that the reserves of the Gibraltar Savings Bank have continued to grow, and these reserves stood at £25.8 million at the close of the last financial year. The reserves of the bank are estimated to grow further to reach over £30 million by the end of the current financial year. This is one of the kitties available to the government, and I don't mean capital, Mr. Speaker, available to the government at any time, and is a fund that has been consistent since we were elected from zero just over 4 years ago. It remains on track to reach £70 million by 2019-20. Indeed, this is one of the rainy day funds that have accumulated and which the government is active to and which we can pay ourselves as a dividend to the required. Mr. Speaker, you have, as we set out extensively in our programme for government at the time of the general election, we are well on track to have rebuilt the rainy day funds, which have been reduced to zero by 2011 when we were elected, to £300 million by 2019-20. This is a process on which we did not start today. It is a process on which we embarked the minute after we were elected in 2011, and it was absolutely right that we should have done so. We are being proved right for having followed that course. The current political circumstances entirely vindicate the view we have taken since we were elected that we should build up these reserves. Already, a total of almost £150 million has been put into rainy day funds in the past 3 years. Gibraltar now has, Mr. Speaker, the largest rainy day fund in its history at its disposal. Given the circumstances in which we find ourselves, I am sure, Mr. Speaker, that the whole of the House and the whole of the community will be very happy indeed with our repeated prudence and our consistent caution in how we have calibrated our spending, despite the criticism to the country, has produced this magnificent rainy day fund, or sovereign wealth fund, to put it in another way, in the sum of £150 million, well on track to reach the £300 million envisaged in our programme for government in November. Mr. Speaker, the Savings Bank continues to provide an excellent range of saving products for our community, and indeed it has done since it was established over 130 years ago. The deposit base of the Savings Bank has now grown to over £1 billion and keeps growing by a considerable amount each month. In fact, despite what some might describe as some attempts to discredit our administration of the affairs of the bank, we have seen it grow consistently and in defiance of the attempt to tarnish it. The Savings Bank is now more robust than ever, stronger than ever, and with greater reserves than ever. This is really to the credit of the work of David Summers, who has demonstrated that he is by far the safest pair of hands for the growth of this institution, having built it up in the late 80s and having now done so again in Ivan Ossoff's magnificent fashion. I know that Mr. Summers loves having very people in the institution. With a figure to have grown an institution like the Savings Bank has still had, and having laid such extraordinarily strong foundations for its standing in good stead in these times of uncertainty, and vindicates the manner in which the Savings Bank has been managed in the time since our election 5 years ago. The strength of the Savings Bank today is a huge asset for the data, and I want to specifically single out the way in which Joe DeSano has doggedly, and despite the repeated criticism, stuck to his plan to strengthen the bank. The Gibraltar Savings Bank will continue to provide savings products to serve our community and will continue to offer special rates of interest to our pensioners under the expert jurisdiction, not just in the ministry of responsibility for it, the department, but also that of the financial secretary. And this is technical speaker. Honourable members will have heard the Governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, say last week that he anticipates that interest rates will be cut again, probably in July and probably also again in August, which will be very bad news indeed for savers everywhere else. We have maintained the product for companies which will maintain their standard of living. The savings bank is also working on improving the other services it offers to savers by making use of the latest available developments in banking technology. And the savings bank now, Mr. Speaker, as all know, complements the services that are being provided to the community by the Gibraltar International Bank, which includes a full range of retail banking services in mortgage finance and prospective homeowners and commercial lending to our local businesses. In its first advertorial slogan to the community, the bank said it was going to be working to deliver your banking needs. Honourable members will agree with me that thanks to the hard work of the people who set up the bank in the most adverse of circumstances, the whole community can now see that this is in fact true, and the community is availing itself of the services and products delivered by the Gibraltar International Bank. The bank opened for business, believe it or not, as recently as May last year, Mr. Speaker. And in that short period of a year and 2 months, since the bank has successfully managed the condition left by the departure of Barclays Bank in the marketplace to little or many bucks, it has already been dealing daily with account openings, online banking services, loans, and of course, mortgages. Indeed, I'm informed that since the bank opened, it has increased its deposit base on a month-by-month basis also, at the same time as the savings bank has done so. And as at the 30th of June, the deposit base of the bank in just over 1 year stood at £244 million. That is to say, Mr. Speaker, just shy of a quarter of a billion pounds sterling and way above the expected figure. This really is, Mr. Speaker, a true reflection of how the community has embraced the Gibraltar International Bank and vested its confidence in it and is actively supporting it. The bank's lending book has also been growing steadily over the months and now stands at £43 million. Overall, the bank has an excess of 7,000 accounts already open in its books. And finally, Mr. Speaker, the Gibraltar International Bank today stands firmly as an established legal bank which is servicing the banking needs of our community and becoming one of the important banks to go to in Gibraltar. And all of it run as the incentive it would be on an entirely independent and commercial basis by a series and highly committed professionals at all levels under an independent board of directors, also exactly as we promised. Mr. Speaker, regardless of what side of the House Honourable Members sit on, they will no doubt want to welcome the success that the Gibraltar International Bank has become. Can I ask that everyone hear this just now on the very hard work indeed that has been done by the independent board, by the executive directors, and by each and every member of the staff of the bank in the process of setting it up, establishing the red line, and making it the success that it is. Mr. Speaker, I will commence now on the process of dealing with the different departments that I have the honour of continuing to have responsibility for after the general election. Mr. Speaker, as honourable members are aware, a public sector human resources business proportionally has been formed to assist all government agencies, authorities, and government-owned companies, and is based on the Sixth Common Law. The new department has brought a commercial approach to non-civil services and human resources, looking at efficiencies and new working practices to improve delivery of service. It has also introduced a best practice approach to the disciplinary process, focusing on restoring efficiency there also. The core of all industrial relations now emanates from this department, which works directly to me in respect of my responsibility for industrial relations. We have been able to form an experience team, which is well respected by all our stakeholders and works well with all of them. The department is still in a developmental stage, and once fully functional, I expect it to bring a high-end service to employees and our customers. I'm also delighted to be able to inform the House that this new service has been welcomed by all three trade unions. Mr. Speaker, I turn now to my responsibility for broadcasting. I'm pleased to report that BBC's progress continues with the feedback received suggesting that Radio Gibraltar remains a firm favourite with listeners' viewers, and viewers are increasingly enjoying programmes on television, and the national broadcasters online and social media platforms are followed in their thousands. This is evidently due to the sheer hard work and commitment of the 80 or so broadcasting professionals now employed by BBC, who, thanks to this government's investment over the past 4 years, are able to deliver the programming and services that Gibraltar wants. It is a necessary investment so that our small nation can pride itself in having its own independent radio and television services with the highest editorial integrity, and it is able to reflect our unique character in the face of hundreds of radio stations and television channels that are available now locally. The past few years have been all about improving the service that BBC provides. Programming is now a far cry from what BBC TV in particular offered years before then. BBC CEO Gareth Gilmour informed him that the road has been tough, but this now it has pretty much leveled out, with the efforts now dedicated to maintaining and wherever possible improving further the quality of local productions and imported programs. Mr. Speaker, television is an expensive business nonetheless, but BBC's management is ensuring that all available resources are maximised to deliver the best value for money possible. TV shows such as our Neanderthals and the research being carried out in Golden Scale and Inspired by General that is currently in production to Aaron Walton and which will trace Gibraltar's Italian ancestry are just two of the many local programs that would only be produced by a local channel. I'm particularly looking forward to that program, given that my ancestry comes from General. This is TVC Dreamer, and they are delivering. The number of local series and specials produced this year are simply too many to mention, but they have been largely well received, not least to say the coverage of the election and the referendum. Mr. Speaker, I'm also glad to report that GBC has acquired affordable rights to see all of the FIFA World Cup qualifier matches as an official host broadcaster. The live broadcast of these matches begins in early September. I'm proud that our national broadcaster is able to cover the matches featuring our national football team. Evidence for these two elements is to speak up for anyone who makes it otherwise, but the Rock is very much a nation in its own right. I'm of course mentioning the BBC Open Day, which last Christmas raised a record-busting £146,000. I pay tribute to the trustees and corporations employees who are involved in this charity, not only for the special programming, but also for bringing the community together for such a worthy cause, which is the Rock's largest collective fundraising effort. Mr. Speaker, broadcasting is a sizable area of employment locally, with 80 persons employed directly by BBC, but also provides opportunities to independent media companies. Careers in the media are exciting and rewarding, and I'm pleased that the government's funding of BBC allows people to fulfill their ambitions in this sector, whilst providing valued service to our community. Increasingly, our own media professionals are also broadening their horizons by working closely with international broadcasters, such as the partnership between GBC and the BBC for coverage of the referendum. This resulted in both broadcasters benefiting from each other's locations and areas of expertise in what was a complicated results programme for all media involved, and in allowing Gibraltar's declaration to be carried not just by Sky and ITV, who were here, but also by the BBC, which is the main broadcaster in the United Kingdom. I was very proud, Mr. Speaker, to see that the NewsWatch results special of Friday evening was subsequently shown on BBC Parliament, providing exposure nationwide in the United Kingdom for the Gibraltar point of view. Although I can say, Mr. Speaker, I was a little surprised, having BBC Parliament on in the background at Gibraltar House in London while we were speaking, to see the BBC NewsWatch logo come up, and I did have to do a double take. Investment in, and I've heard about reverse takeovers, Mr. Speaker, but I never expected that the BBC would be taking over the BBC. Investment in technology needs to continue, and this year the corporation has replaced its studio and field production cameras, which will allow the HD high-quality picture to be maintained. Radio studios were also refurbished with some equipment upgraded. The focus on the new financial year is on the replacement of the current and aging TV studio lighting grid with much more environmentally friendly LED lights, as well as the upgrading of the station's satellite transmission facilities. Speaker, there is generally a good story to tell about BBC, but the truth is that our national broadcaster continues to operate from a location that is simply not fit for purpose. For this reason, and in keeping with our electoral pledge, BBC's relocation needs to happen soon and in a manner that will finally provide BBC with a decent working environment that includes an energy infrastructure and allows our national broadcaster to deliver the best possible television and radio for our citizens. This would also provide the vehicle for BBC to diversify and capitalise on commercial opportunities that should in turn reduce its reliance on public subsidy. Mr. Speaker, I'm sure that with their proven determination, GBC's professionals will make the most of any new opportunity that comes their way to the mutual benefit of its employees and the broader as a whole. I now turn, Mr. Speaker, to my responsibilities. The complement of Asian customs following the review is now complete, with the final recruit training class concluded in December 2015. We have now employed 65 additional officers over the last 2 years, and taking into consideration retirements during the period, a total of 79 new officers have joined the department since 2015. This has led to the creation of a new control section at the commercial gate, four self-contained operational ships deployed subject to operational requirements, a 24/7 marine unit of revamped flexible anti-smuggling team, and increases in training, administration, and IT officers. Mr. Speaker, it's interesting that in relation to customs, in fact, there is now much to declare. The Honourable Member will be pleased to note that these increases in human resources have led to additional disruptions across all sections in both the transit of risk goods and evasion of duty. During the last year, we have relocated and provided temporary officer working facilities for the control section and outfield, and are working closely with the collector on other relocations, including that of the wholly accustomed house, the same in ETE and the dog detector, the drug detector and dog section. As members of the House are aware, I am in the process of taking direct responsibility for drug policy to ensure government drugs and the revolting drug problem is dealt with directly from the heart of government. To this end, the forces have been developed within customs have a dedicated team working primarily on tackling drug imports. During this year, marine and ship crews have detected and seized almost half a ton of cannabis, and a number of ribs have also been seized. Mr. Speaker, I expect to say more about my ministerial work in relation to this area of responsibility in the near future. One of the other areas tackled by his customs is the illicit trade in tobacco products. In October 2015, Her Majesty's Customs signed a memorandum of understanding with Philip Morris International, the world's leading international tobacco company, which establishes a framework for cooperation to combat the illicit trade in tobacco. A result of that collaboration with PMI is the testing of its Codentify system, which is an electronic application to combine authentication, verification, and track and trace surveillance. Customs is presently working closely with the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development to develop systems to test the effectiveness of co-identified or identified counterfeits and the supply chain of cigarettes. A port cabin has now been cited as a member of the committee of esteem at Eastern Beach Road as a staging point for officers and high visibility patrols in that area of the frontier fence and beach. And the collective customs has also signed a memorandum of understanding to open a United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, Gibraltar Centre of Excellence, which will be housed within the University of Gibraltar and which will provide specialist training programs for high level international governmental and private sector officials on customs related matters. Members of the House can imagine that this was not without its attempt at forfeiture. The centre is expected to be fully operational in August and a number of high level workshops have already been arranged for the autumn. A stopover by UK border force cattle in September on their return from operations in the Mediterranean, presenting an opportunity for the UK border force officers to undertake training exercises, share experience and best practice, and meet informally with their counterparts in Haitian customs in Gibraltar. This has resulted in further training as a common opportunity for border force both in UK and in Gibraltar. In May of this year, the collective custody of Rodriguez was elected into the European Association of Airport and Seaport Police Executive Committee funding to the Gibraltar to be truly proud of, a forum where international experts share their experiences and best practices with regards to the challenges of international collaboration in the changing world of border and port security. The event, attended by over 60 law enforcement and security professionals from across Europe, focused on aviation and maritime security discussions that discussed current threats and opportunities to disrupt criminal and terrorist security. During the course of the past year, I have attended three passing out parades for the first in many years, and was impressed with the level of professionalism and knowledge of the new recruits and all rounds present, and it was an honour to share such an occasion with their friends, colleagues and families. Our customs officers, Mr. Speaker, like the officers of all our law enforcement agencies, are a credit to our community. They demonstrate that we invest and are committed to tackling the trade in drugs and other illicit goods in a real and meaningful manner. They are excellent ambassadors for the culture, and I am indeed proud to have the ministerial responsibility for their sterling work. Mr. Speaker, I now turn to my responsibilities as Chairman of the Borders and Coast Guard Agency, where we have made major improvements since we came to office in 2011. More recently, as promised in our 2015 election manifesto, we have now fully integrated the Highway Enforcement Officers into the agency, providing additional manpower required to meet the challenges of the increased workload. And we have also employed a large number of additional female officers to ensure that the agency is suitably balanced to carry out the gender-specific work it does and to remain compliant to the Civil Aviation Authority and Department of Transport standards and requirements. Particularly, officers of the Border and Coast Guard Agency go through extensive training in a range of disciplines and responsibilities. They are multifunctional and can react according to the risks and requirements that they face. This last year has been a very successful year for the agency, whose efforts have been recognized internationally by Borderpay, the International Border Security, Immigration and Traveler Management Organization, for its outstanding vision, dedication and commitment to progressive border security, traveler and migration management. The agency, the Gibraltar agency, Mr. Speaker, was presented with the Excellence in Border Management Award at the Border for World Congress in The Hague in December 2015. This award not only recognizes the agency's efforts, but more importantly, provides us with international exposure, especially among countries such as Singapore, whose immigration and checkpoint authority were the recipient before us in 2014. In addition to this accolade, Mr. Speaker, the Chief Executive has been elected to form part of Borderpol's Common Council, which has set up to oversee strategic operational programs and provide a platform that respects global border security, migration, and travel and management issues. Mr. Speaker, with over 12 million people coming into Gibraltar every year, and the increase in flights and cruise liner visits, the agency continues, particularly at the land frontier, to face the ever-increasing challenge of maintaining a fluid but secure border. This government is pleased that investing not only in additional human resources, but also in the latest available technology in passport scanners, advanced passenger information systems, and CCTV and facial recognition cameras. All of this have enabled the agency to work closely with UK border force, come up to each other and home office in the UK and Interpol in developing a very successful border service operation. Together with the magnificent men and women of the world of border police and the other emergency essential services, the agency is very much at the forefront of our fight against terrorism, working hard to ensure that those who would rather not see Gibraltar because of the fear to carry out criminal actions and harm are indeed kept out. And this is unsurprisingly as a result of these entry over the last year to over 35,000 people, Mr. Speaker, more than the population of Gibraltar. Mr. Speaker, it is impossible to ignore the migration crisis in Southeast Europe and Greece in particular. We are lucky enough to enjoy relative safety here in Gibraltar. But as the EU tightens its borders in the east of the Mediterranean, we cannot overlook the fact that migration routes may well shift along the northwestern African coast towards Morocco and thus closer to us, and indeed the challenges that may bring. The increased security posture has placed considerable strain on all of our security services, and the agency's men and women continue to work tirelessly to ensure the border can combat the increased numbers of organized criminals attempting to travel illegally, particularly to the UK via Gibraltar. The agency works on the premise of an open but secure border and works with colleagues at the RTP, UK Border Force, and Spain for the CIA National and indeed Interpol for its users. It also works particularly closely with Her Majesty's Government Home Office, with the Malaysia and Overseas Network in the United Kingdom, which coordinates immigration intelligence work overseas and spreads intelligence to provide that outer cordon which aims to stop illegal immigration and those who would rather not be in the border but into our borders. So the people working with this Home Office Overseas Network has led to the successful disruption of organized immigration crime and trafficking operations, with the exception of a number of organized criminal human trafficking units trying to get Albanian, Chinese, and Iraqi nationals illegally into the UK through Gibraltar. And the Speaker, the agency strives to ensure Gibraltar is not seen as a soft underbelly for illegal access to the UK, and in addition to its entry checks to the border regularly carried out random exit checks at the airport. But thankfully, as does the wider law enforcement community around the world, ever increasing challenges as criminals improve their resources in counterfeiting and adopting stolen original travel documents in their attempts to travel undetected. Mr. Speaker, the agency has worked very hard to become the focal point for a more central immigration service in Gibraltar, and the Immigration and Asylum and Refugee Act currently under review will reflect this. It aspires and is working hard to ensure that operation is very much in place and service continues to set for itself, increasingly demanding and challenging objectives. It remains focused to working in partnership with other government departments and law enforcement agencies, both locally and abroad, and to exchange information and intelligence of mutual interest to provide solutions and improve the overall level of immigration service to both provide. One of their objectives here is to focus on working closely with the ship agents to facilitate and improve the migration process of 20,000 or so ships that transit through Gibraltar each year, Mr. Speaker. The agency is committed to professionalism and in fact is always looking at ways in which to improve itself and the service it provides, whether it be seeking changes to policy or operation, the professional development of individuals, collective training, or indeed social media presence. The management team, together with my office, has worked hard to establish a solid administrative structure and continue working closely with the unions to explore ways in which we can best develop the agency's future. I'm happy to say that we're in the final stages of ratifying the changes requested by the unions, which will see further improvements to the collective agreement. Finally, Mr. Speaker, I want to thank you, finally publicly thank the men and women of the Baltimore Coast Guard Agency for the invaluable work that they do at the site, making gains to Gibraltar, because their work is often difficult to measure and communicate, and it is all too often the case on the motion. The Speaker, as regards to the Civil State Administration Office, I can report that it has been a challenging but productive year. A year which has seen the retirement of the head of the department and the resulting staffing adjustments, which are still ongoing. On this note, I'd like to thank officers from other departments, including the Human Resources Department, Number 6, Common Growth and the Board of Agency for their support and assistance to the CSIA. In line with our practice established since Gibraltar Liberal Alliance came into office 4.5 years ago, we are proud to have conducted the granting of disability charity citizenship. At long last, we have been able to do justice with our sacrifices made by long-term, non-EEA national interventions of our community. However, by far the greatest challenge this year has been the complete overhaul of our local identity and civil registration card. The decision was taken early in our first term of office to work towards the replacement of our former ID card, as has already been done with our driving license, in order to enhance the features of us at the same time pave the way for greater e-government transactions. A massive local and logistical exercise was embarked upon, not without its teething problems, but thanks to the efforts and contributions from our staff at the CFRO, as well as other officers and some students, the inevitable technical difficulties and challenges have been addressed. The support of my internal ICLD department and the specialist consultants engaged to design and produce the cards. Already, with the Speaker, approximately 39,000 cards have been issued. In the year ahead, the exercise will be seen to completion. The Speaker, during the last 12 months, the Income Tax Office has continued its program aimed at improving the assessment and collection of taxes into data, and this is such an important part of our revenue. In this regard, the amendments to the Income Tax Act 2010 introduced in the last financial year have made the legislation clearer and more robust. The relation to all aspects of tax law assessment, the Income Tax Office is carrying on with the implementation of measures addressing delayed issues in a positive manner. The corporate tax yield in the financial year 2015-16 has reached a record high of £109,374,117. This represents a significant increase of approximately 23% over the government's corporate tax yield in the 2014-15 financial year. In respect of tax yield, the government's income tax office continues to show the effective strategy of close, dynamic, and direct communication with employers to ensure compliance with our tax rules. A culture of compliance is being nurtured and encouraged amongst the general public taxpayers by this strategy. The fruits of these efforts are evident from the improved yield in the arrears recovered by the government. In particular, the income tax office takes a very stringent approach on employers that do not comply with their tax paying obligations. As part of the next stages in the Commission's strategy and objectives, is to publish a name and pay list in the Gibraltar Government Gazette, setting out the names of those employers that have defaulted on their COAY payments. Furthermore, new provisions have been introduced in the Income Tax Act 2010 in the last financial year, empowering the Commissioner by also extending his legal authority to publish details of self-employed individuals and the companies in the Gibraltar Gazette who fail to meet their obligations. The programme of improvement continues steadily and is an evolutionary process without losing sight of clear objectives to achieve a streamlined, accessible, and user-friendly service to all taxpayers in Gibraltar. The changes to counter hours, providing a continuous, uninterrupted service from 8:30 a.m. to 3 p.m., has been a resounding and unqualified success as much in the income tax office as in the wider civil service. I want to congratulate all public servants for this. In tandem, Mr. Speaker, the implementation of the Income Tax Office's new webpage, including user-friendly portal, has fallen part of the wider e-government platform, has been very positive and favorable feedback from users. The ongoing modernization of systems in the Income Tax Office has upgraded the administrative efficiency of the back office, resulting in significant reduction in the time spent refiling and accessing files. The ultimate objective for the Income Tax Office is to phase in the scanning and digitization of all tax files and records. The increased systems on the payment of tax by debit cards has provided a popular choice for taxpayers, and the banking facilities for the refunds are directly credited to taxpayers' bank accounts avoid the hassle and inconvenience associated with taxing checks. The multifaceted approach to make taxation easier to understand and the awareness of taxpayers' obligations has been very successful initiatives. Presentations and attendance at seminars aimed at the business sector have contributed to the success of the outreach program. In particular, the advertisement of important tax reminders in the local press has contributed to the success in achieving greater compliance across the entire spectrum of taxpayers. The Income Tax Office has also maintained a dedicated scientific approach in the discovery of species and functions for the purpose of exchange of information, in compliance with the obligations applied by the EU under EU directive and under the OECD obligation, they have ensured that these obligations are met competently and consistently and on time. The income tax office has deployed its resources in relation to the ever-increasing demands placed on advanced national tax compliance and major inroads are being made. The amendments to the Income Tax Act 2007 introduced in the last financial year include the obligation for all companies registered in Gibraltar to file a full and complete return of their income. In order to facilitate the registration of such a significant number of companies, the Income Tax Office has introduced a fast track system which allows for the bulk registration of all Gibraltar registered companies that were not previously registered with the Income Tax Office. The Income Tax Office has in fact embarked on this process and in doing so has maintained close relations with the finance sector industry. Forming part of the government's package of information technology initiatives, the ICA is working closely with the information technology and logistics departments to enable companies to submit their returns online. It is intended to extend this facility to all taxpayers of the property. Mr. Speaker, there has always, however, been an amount of tax refunds due to be processed in the system. However, a significant increase in tax refund fee and personal assessment first delays would be introduction of the gross income based system of taxation in 2007-2008. Many of the members may recall that this effectively created a dual system of personal taxation in today. Under this dual taxation system, created by the former administration, the Income Tax Office calculates the amount payable by the taxpayer under both systems and then issues an assessment on the more favorable of the two taxation systems for the benefit of the taxpayer. The practical effect of this is that a significant number of taxpayers have in effect been migrated from the allowance-based system to the gross income-based system after having been assessed. The initial use of the system resulted in a sharp increase in the numbers and amount of tax refunds due, and this backlog of refunds has been trailing since then. The problem has been further compounded with the introduction of the system of payments and accounts in 2010 for both companies and self-employed individuals, which has also resulted in a further increase in tax refunds due. Under this system, payments on accounts are made based on the previous year's results. Although the system allows for the timely collection of tax on accounts, for any such company or self-employed individuals who subsequently reported a lower profit or income level, the tax overpaid is refunded accordingly. In the initial years following the introduction of the system, the focus has been on ensuring that it worked correctly and reported were deployed accordingly. Mr. Speaker, nonetheless, my government has responded to the consequences of these tax system changes by increasing the annual provision for tax refunds so that they are now higher than they ever were before. Honourable members will want to note and support that there is provision of £10 million in legal estimates on the consolidated fund charges for the head 7-1 for the payment of refunds during 2016-17, the highest in 2015. This compares with a provision of £7 million in 2015-16, an actual refund of £6.6 million in 2014-15, £10.6 million in 13-14, £6.6 million in 12-13, £5.7 million in 11-12, and only £4.7 million in 2011. With a provision of £10 million in this year's budget, which is the highest amount ever provided for refunds, the Income Tax Office will be able to continue with its ongoing refund program to catch up on the backlog of refunds resulting from the introduction of the gross income-based system in 2007-2008. The Income Tax Office has now finalised all tax assessments for the years 2009-10, 2010-11, and the tax assessments for the years 11-12 and 12-13 should be finalised this year. Their refunds program is presently being worked on with a view to making significant inroads into the processing of the refund scheme over the next 2 years. The government, Mr. Speaker, does not wish to keep people's money. Finally, and more sadly in relation to this important department, Frank Cavillo, the Commissioner of Income Tax, is retiring from his post this year. He will be sorely missed, not just in this department, but throughout the government service. Frank has been a close advisor and a pillar of sound judgment in all the time I've been in office, and I have no doubt that all those in my predecessors who have worked with him will feel the same way. I know he has also been an important servant of this House at election time and has been a great asset to Her Majesty's government of Gibraltar generally. In his time, he has overseen a huge growth in income tax receipts and has been instrumental in guiding the work our legal teams have done on the EU state aid matters. Indeed, I'm sure that the only persons who will be happy to see him go are those that he has quite properly named and shamed for their failure to comply with their obligations. Frank has agreed to continue to stay involved in helping to deal with general government careers, and I have no doubt he will still be available to advise a friendly chief minister at least once in a while. Mr. Speaker, last year the talk of the town was that power cuts and the greatest challenge facing our economy then was the provision of a reliable source of power and the installation of the necessary generation capacity for our community for a generation. Mr. Speaker, one of the most important aspects of that process is the choice of location for the new power station and the choice of fuel for the future. Anyone who now cares to cast an eye towards the North Mole will not fail to see the significant progress that has been made by Wick in the construction of that facility. The engine bays that will house the new workhorses that will provide Gibraltar power needs are now virtually complete. Delivery of the Caterpillar engine is expected by around November of this year, as they have passed through the delivery testing processes. The whole house will no doubt be delighted to hear that. At the same time, as this is ongoing, over the last 6 months, senior government officials have been engaged with Shell representatives to seek to finalise the arrangements for the LNG facility that will supply LNG to the new power station. These negotiations are highly technical, as they need to cover the thousands of their contracts spanning some 20 years. Careful consideration has, of course, been given to ensure that LNG is supplied to the border safely and reliably, to keep the power station constantly working under this new fuel that will dramatically reduce emissions and produce cleaner and more efficient power. Gone will be the days of grimy, smelly, dirty diesel power and pollution. In addition, the cost formula agreed with Shell for LNG supply will make the use of gas cheaper than powering our engines with diesel. Mr. Speaker, discussions on the safety case have been fully aired in the Parliament, the election campaign, and the vote. I can assure the Parliament that no stone has been left unturned in this respect. As I have said repeatedly before, neither I nor any other minister on these benches, or any other member of my professional staff, would tolerate an installation which introduced an intolerable risk to our community. Shell has proved to be the right choice for this nation as we have experienced their attention to detail and vigilant eye on the safety case. The team have repeatedly visited Gibraltar and have been great specialists in all aspects of this process. For our part, teams from the port have visited Shell's representative gate facility, which will supply LNG to the Gibraltar plant point which is operational. In October, teams from the Environmental Agency, the Gibraltar Fire and Rescue Service, the Gibraltar Port Authority, and the Gibraltar Electricity Authority will visit Shell's Gatineau offices in Bergen, their LNG terminal and production site in Bergen, and to their LNG safety training facility in Rotterdam to see these aspects hand and attend training sessions as appropriate. It is expected that negotiations will be finalised in the next month or so in respect of the final agreement with Shell. Interim arrangements have been entered into with Shell, which have allowed them to progress with ordering the construction of the tanks being specifically designed for the goal. In addition, Mr. Speaker, the House will be pleased to hear that it is expected that Shell commission works will also commence in part shortly on the North Mole after the agreement is signed and the final standing conditions are met. I cannot begin to explain to honourable members, Mr. Speaker, how complex this process is and how proud I am of the team of the Gibraltar Electricity Authority responsible for supervising the wider power station project. On this issue, I have of course been working with the relevant minister, Dr. John Cortez, and particularly mentioned Mr. Renee of Michael Caetano, the CEO of the GEA, and Mr. Mansabe, the government's chief technical officer. I also need to recognize the dedication of Manolo Alessi, who has been instrumental in the design of the power station, working on this up to his retirement, and who continues to assist in and advise his capacity with this project. Manolo was part of the team who worked with me together with Michael Gill as the then chief technical officer to consider the options for the water from a blank canvas. I cannot thank Manolo enough for his friendship, support, and advice in the period of analysis, consideration, and procurement that led to the choices we have made and are now happily implementing. Mr. Speaker, trying to coordinate both processes, power station and an LNG facility, is not easy, with everyone needing to be coordinated to ensure that the tanks are in place and the LNG plant is functional by the time that the new power station engines are ready to test it. I'm delighted to inform Bowen that we are well on track with both of these challenging and inexplicably linked projects. The LNG plant will be operated by Shell, whose presence in Gibraltar will be through a 51% subsidiary aptly named Shell LNG Gibraltar Limited. In order to reduce the overall cost of this contract over 20 year life of the board taxpayer, the government will own the remaining 49% of the shares, ensuring government shares in the economic benefits of this arrangement. The total cost of the facility is circa $44 million over a period of 2 years, and at the end of the 20-year contract period, the plant will revert to full government ownership for a nominal payment. The details of these LNG arrangements are not yet finalized, but this outlines for the House the anticipated outcome of the negotiations. Mr. Speaker, my administration, just like the former administration, has also taken the view that infrastructure facilities such as the power station, which are for the long-term benefit of the community, should be funded on a long-term basis. With this in mind, I can confirm that we have secured financing for the power station through a financing agreement that was entered into just before the 31st of March 2016 between Lombard plc, which is part of the Royal Bank of Scotland Group, and EF Limited, which is the company that is owning the power station facility. The facility is an asset finance arrangement for £55 million, being the part of the construction contract represented by the asset in EF Limited. The facility is being drawn down against stage payments. Facilities are payable over 10 years post construction by making equal annual payments, which can easily be met from the savings of fuel alone. The remaining balance of money due on this contract is at present anticipated to be financed directly from government company sources. Mr. Speaker, the new power station financing is more than affordable when one factors in the savings that will be made when government also enters contract with energy for the temporary rental facility, and even more so when the government is released from the fuel hedge arrangements put in place when diesel prices were in excess of $100 a barrel. The cost of this facility is at a margin of 2.98%. This is because just under 3% of UK rivals, making this an exceptionally attractive facility that does not require the government's balance sheet as security. The facility also provides a drop lock option, allowing EF Limited to fix the interest rate. This choice will be allowed once during the lifetime of the facility, with a decision available at each anniversary of the facility. Mr. Speaker, it is right that I should take this opportunity to thank David Bruce from NatWest, Ian Victor, Robin Clayton, and Lance Popper from Lombard for working with us to make this innovative financing arrangement possible, which does not, Mr. Speaker, which does not require us to raise electricity prices to consumers by 5% per year for 20 years, as was anticipated in the financing arrangements which were entered into by the former administration. Mr. Speaker, the new power station project and the new LNG storage facility for it are amongst the most exciting, essential, and critical projects for the community, and it is a pleasure to have been able to see both of them well on the way to being delivered for the benefit of all. Mr. Speaker, another of the exciting, essential, and critical projects for the future of the community is the completion of the tunnel under the runway. In this respect, the government is pleased to be able to announce that it has successfully negotiated a settlement with Obrascom Ward Delay SA or OHA to complete the runway. Not only was the settlement avoid further delays by requiring the contractor to complete the tunnel by the 30th of November 2018, it will do so at a price close to the original 2008 budget. The completion contract is in fact explicitly specified that any delay for the contract completion date would immediately incur financial penalties to be paid to the government by OHA. This settlement therefore provides government and the taxpayer with the certainty of the completion date and also with certainty of cost. Having originally contracted to pay OHA $30 million for the tunnel in 2008, OHA will now receive a total sum of no more than £24 million. This amount includes the sums already paid. The reduction in prices contributes towards the cost and expenses incurred by the Majesty Government of Gibraltar since termination. This includes the cost of certain work undertaken directly by the government wholly owned Gibraltar Joinery and Building Services Limited. The risk involved in completing the tunnel project will now be assumed by OHA rather than by the government, and our current position is further increased in having our obtained banking guarantees in the total sum of £37.1 million in favour of the government to ensure OHA's performance of the work. Because that is bonds to the government of 37, bank guarantees of £37.1 million to ensure OHA's performance of the work. Government will also be able to pursue OHA for further sums if they fail to deliver. A completely fresh OHL team for their international division is being brought in to ensure delivery of a project in accordance with the new completion obligations. OHL will be mobilizing on site during the early part of July, although formal commencement under the Confucian context will be as formal commencement under the Confucian context will be as of the 1st of August 2016. The speaker, the government has already stated publicly, this settlement with OSA ensures that the final cost of the panel will be as close as we could hope for to achieve what was originally budgeted. The result also de-risks the process which is also quite considerable. I want to place on record, on the record of handset, the government thanks to the team at CSN comprising Guy Spinelli and Nick Piazza, the team at Corbett & Co. led by Edward Corbett, and also to Mr. Nigel Pfizer and Stephen O'Shea and Joe Villapal, who have been involved throughout. Additionally, I'm also grateful to the team in-house within Her Majesty's Settlement of the World Bank, particularly Michael Gates, Mr. Montada, James Diane, Albert Menner, the now Financial Secretary, and the former Chief Minister, Peter Cabrera, who have been a great assistance in the litigation leading up to this result. I also want to thank you, JBS, who have abused it, stepped into the breach when they were needed by the people going back there, and they could have done a great job of finishing the panel we had asked them. The work they have done, and have continued, is as usual of a very high standard, and I want to thank them for that work. Mr. Speaker, I think everyone will now look forward to seeing this important infrastructure project completed as soon as possible by the date of the week and on the new budget. Mr. Speaker, I now turn to the specific budget measures for the financial year 2016. As honourable members are aware, the government's policies to enhance, protect and secure our housing estate. We have invested very considerable amounts of almost £100 million in upgrading many of our housing blocks, and we remain committed to this ongoing programme of modernisation and improvement. At the same time, Mr. Speaker, the government has noted the remarks in the Ombudsman's report this year in relation to the need to review housing rents. First of all, I want to congratulate the Honourable and Learned Lady, the Minister for Housing, for her fantastic work in collecting arrears of housing rents. She will be telling the House more in her intervention, no doubt, about how much she has already collected in arrears and what she plans to continue to do. Going forward, the position of all parties at the last general election was that housing rates should be reviewed, given that they had not been increased since 1984. As the Germans in Gibraltar in 1984, which was, of course, before the full opening of the frontier, were £126 per week, whilst average earnings in 2015 were £555 per week, a rise of 340%. Inflation in that time has risen by 153.5%. As a first budget measure this year, Mr. Speaker, I announce that government residential rent will therefore be increased this year for the first time in 32 years by only 3%, which will amount to an average of 60p per week. The increase will amount to 39p for a two-bedroom property at a major estate, or 46p per week for a two-bedroom property at the Mid-Harbour estate. That is to say, less than half the price of one edition of the Gibraltar Chronicle a week, or they are not proposing that anybody should profit by buying the Chronicle. I trust that all honourable members would agree with me that that means testing these increases. That means testing these increases would cost more than the increases and makes no sense. These are very modest increases that must now continue on an annual basis in a manner that will nonetheless remain considerably below where they would have been if they had been increased consistently in line with inflation. Whilst the former administration put in place a scheme to sell off our housing stock assets by extending the right to buy scheme to post-war accommodation, we instead have decided to retain the housing estate as long-term public housing and to maintain them to a higher standard than ever before. Although the right to buy scheme in respect of pre-war or free-standing property will continue, our priority will be to implement this in a way that keeps the bulk of post-war housing estates within the public sector. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, instead of selling off these prized assets to those money, as was previously proposed by the former administration, we are delighted to have secured £300 million in new institutional investment in Gibraltar and the strength of our enhanced 2030 public housing stock. This significant investment represents an important vote of confidence in Gibraltar's economy. The £300 million investment has varying maturities of between 15 to 30 years at fixed interest rates. Indeed, securing this investment at this time has been critical in order to benefit from currently very low interest rates. Accordingly, the composite rate for the overall investment has come in at 3.85%. The securities have been placed with funds managed by MMG, MetLife and Babson, each of which are major institutional wealth managers. The Royal Bank of Canada Capital Markets has acted out of London as a private placement agent. the investment has been structured through the government company structure via Gibraltar Capital Assets Limited, a newly incorporated subsidiary of the Gibraltar Development Corporation. GCA has the benefit of long leasehold interest in six of Gibraltar's public housing estates. The freehold title to all housing estates remains with the ground, and the security of all tenants is completely unaffected and secure. GCA has a very strong local board of directors consisting of James Levy, PC, the senior partner of the firm, chairman, John Corrado, the current and soon to be retired managing director of LPS, and Charles Cahilla, a senior and highly respected chartered accountant. The government and the housing authority will remain fully responsible for the allocation, repair, and maintenance of the housing estate. Mr. Speaker, this massive investment in Gibraltar has involved considerable planning and effort, and I want to thank all the investors, financial institutions, and advisors for having brought about this successful outcome. Indeed, this is all the more remarkable, given the transaction was structured and completed in advance of notwithstanding the potential impact of a Brexit vote on the 2017, not easily anticipated on the basis of the new tourism. In fact, Mr. Speaker, this transaction has served to highlight the very positive view of international investors in the strength and resilience of investment in Gibraltar. I want to specifically thank the Financial Secretary, Albert Mena, who originated, recommended, and has seen through the concept of structuring this investment in Gibraltar in this innovative manner. My thanks also to Albert Mena's team for their work on this transaction and all of the work that they do on these estimates, as well as Peter Mandarico, PC, and his legal team for their invaluable work and advice in respect of this matter, as well as to the Minister for Housing, Samantha Ferramenta, and Terry Redding and her hard-working team at the Ministry for Housing. Mr. Speaker, Albert Mena has been an important part of the delivery of this economic performance. He is an extraordinary talent, an extraordinarily committed individual, and he has extraordinary skills. At this difficult time, it is clear that Gibraltar needs his abilities and skill set at its disposal, and I am honoured that he accepted the challenge I put to him to become a part of my team at Number 6 Common Place in behalf of Government and Financial Secretary, although I must say I was dismayed indeed at some of the attempts to which he was subjected in November, and which I have no doubt many will now regret. It has filtered, as it also found now, Mr. Speaker, before I launch into the rest of the night, private measures, all of my team at Number 6. They know who they are, Mr. Speaker, for their fantastic work and support this very difficult election and referendum year. Mr. Speaker, the following changes in import duty will be introduced with immediate effect. In order to assist the community with the purchase of vision, collection aids and accessories, import duty on spectacles is reduced from 6% to 0%. Import duty on spectacle lenses is reduced from 12% to 0%. Import duty on contact lenses is reduced from 12% to 0%. Mr. Speaker, can I just pause there and say that I wear glasses and have contact lenses in case anybody should care to get later that it is inappropriate for me not to have done so. Mr. Speaker, in order to contribute to a healthier diet amongst our children and at the same time promote physical education and sports in both our primary and secondary schools, import duty at 10% will be payable on fizzy and other soft drinks other than milk-based drinks with a sugar content of above 5 grams per 100 millimetres. The same level of input duty will be levied on sugar, sweeteners, or other derivatives used for the sweetening of drinks produced in Gibraltar, which have the same sugar content. As a further measure for the benefit of our school children, and I, Mr. Speaker, will declare that I have too, import duty on school fat sales is reduced from 6% to 0. Mr. Speaker, in order to assist our community with the purchase of everyday essential items, import duty on sanitary towels and tampons is reduced from 12% to 0. This is because of the legendary tampon price, which suddenly was part of our general election debate, Mr. Speaker. Nappies and nappy liners for babies have their input duties reduced from 12% to 0. Mr. Speaker, I can bet one of my children still wears nappies, Mr. Speaker. Pre-sale, saving and after-sale corporations have their import duty reduced from 3% to 0%. Personal deodorant and antiperspirant is reduced on import duty from 3% to 0%. Austrian bath salts and other bath preparations is reduced from 3% to 0%. I think I think that we have a very sweet-smelling community indeed as a result of these measures. Mr. Speaker, in order to assist local businesses in the marine sector, duty on electronic equipment and spare parts for use exclusively in boats, including fish finders, marine raiders, radar and GPS plotters is reduced, probably for the chagrin of the Minister for the Environment, to speak up from 12% to zero. Duty on sails is reduced from 3% to zero. Duty on propellers and related parts is reduced from 12% to zero. With the speaker in support of this government's continuing efforts to address the problems arising from tobacco and smoking generally, we will raise the import duty on watertight tobacco from the current 4% overall duty to £3 per kilo. This represents a threefold increase in import duty on this commodity. Mr. Speaker, in order to assist with the cost of doing business in Gibraltar, increasing their water charges will not be increased this year, despite the increasing cost of providing these public utilities. Given that inflation since January 2012, the month after we were elected, has amounted to 5.65% in that period, Mr. Speaker, that is the discount in real terms that businesses have had already since our election against the amount of which water and electricity are charged. But this is, Mr. Speaker, a huge discount already against the amount that it costs to generate electricity and water, both of which are costs which are now heavily subsidised by the government and which we will continue to subsidise, Mr. Speaker. General rates payable by businesses will also remain unchanged, and discounts for the early payment of rates will continue to apply. But Speaker, as I mentioned, the Brexit vote is created uncertain times, and my government is determined to ensure that whilst in Gibraltar business continues as usual, Gibraltar remains competitive internationally and will continue to attract top quality businesses to Gibraltar. In order to encourage any business doing setting up in Gibraltar due to situation, the government will implement a start-up incentive. An incentive of this sort, although not quite in the form, has already been advocated by the Gibraltar Society of Accountants and the Gibraltar Federation of Small Businesses. Nonetheless, the impact that they were suggesting, we believe, is achieved by what we are going to propose. In simple terms, the incentive is as follows. Any company that sets up in Gibraltar over the next 12 months and meets the following conditions will be eligible for this incentive. The conditions are that the company must be a new business setting up in the period from the date of the speech to the 30th of June 2017. The business must employ at least 5 employees in its first year. The business must not represent a transfer of a business previously existing in Gibraltar, or one that is used as a transfer pricing mechanism to allocate profits from a business previously existing in Gibraltar. Anti-avoidance provisions will be applied to ensure the settlement of new business setting up in Gibraltar. And the incentive will be available to companies or limited partnerships, but not for individuals changing in their own name. And Mr. Speaker, the incentive is this. Over the first 3 financial years of trading of the startup business, the company will be eligible for a tax credit equal to the tax due up to a maximum of £50,000 over each of the first 3 years. The tax credit does not carry forward from 1 year to the next. Therefore, if the company does not make a profit and is unable to make use of it as a result, it is not eligible for repayment by the tax office. The incentive simply acts as a mechanism to shelter a liability to tax up to a maximum tax equivalent to £50,000 per annum, thereby effectively sheltering £500,000 or £500,000 of profit per annum. My government believes this mechanism will provide an incentive to those businesses presently considering Gibraltar as a place to set up a new business. Mr. Speaker, as members of the House may be aware, the former administration introduced rates of social insurance contributions of 20% for employers and 10% for employees on the 1st of April 2007 in a bid to make the funds self-funded. These increases were initially capped at £26.20 for the employer and £20.25 for the employee as of the 1st of April 2007. These rates were payable up to the 30th of June 2008. In their last term in the office on the 1st of July 2010, the party opposite increased the cap to £32.97 for employers and £25.15 for employees. There have been no increases since July 2010. The government is nonetheless committed to a total reform of the entire structure of the Social Insurance Fund in order to place it on a viable footing. Mr. Speaker, given the Brexit vote, announcing the reform system now will not allow us to benefit from the potential flexibility which might be possible in the context of current EU rules that perhaps no longer being applicable. An announcement will therefore be made in due course in respect of this new system once the government receives legal advice that the new system is fully compliant either with EU law as it is and will continue to apply or with whatever new regime is in place. For now, Mr. Speaker,
given the seismic effect that the Brexit decision has had on financial markets and businesses, after very careful consideration and after detailed consultation with United Union, with the Federation of Small Businesses, and with the Chamber of Commerce, the government will not increase social insurance contributions. We will observe the effect of the decision on business in Gibraltar and will necessarily make the necessary increases at the beginning of the calendar year in January 2017. Mr. Speaker, in pursuance of the government's continued commitment to reduce the level of personal taxation, especially for the lower paid members of our community, with effect from the 1st of July 2016, taxpayers with an assessable income of £11,050 or less will be brought out of the taxation system altogether and will pay no income tax. This applies to taxpayers in both the allowance-based system and the gross income-based system. In accordance with our manifesto commitment, taxpayers under the allowance system will benefit from an increase in their personal allowances, which is at least in line with inflation. This means that people most in need in our community who benefit from these allowances will not see them frozen. With effect on the 1st of July 2016, the following allowance increases will be applied. The personal allowance is increased from £3,200 to £3,215. The spouse and civil partner's allowance is increased from £3,200 to £3,215. The one-parent family allowance is increased from £5,254 to £5,290. The nursery allowance is increased from £5,000 to £5,025, because I have a child of nursery. The speaker, the child allowance is increased from £1,100 to £1,105. The child studying abroad allowance will increase from £1,250 to £1,255. The dependent relative allowance is increased where the relative is resident in Gibraltar from £300 to £305, and where the relative is resident outside Gibraltar from £200 to £205. The disabled individual allowance is increased from £9,000 to £9,040. The blind allowance is increased from £5,000 to £5,020, and the medical insurance allowance is increased from £5,000 to £5,020. Mr. Speaker, so the communications companies are currently liable to pay company tax at a higher rate of 20% on all their taxable income. This applies not only to the taxable income on the business generated from the provision of telecommunications services, but also for the taxable income on the businesses generated from their non-telecommunications services, such as data centers. In order to ensure a level playing field, company tax at a higher rate of 20% should apply only to the profits and gains arising from the telecommunications activities, which are specifically mentioned in the Income Tax Act, and the lower 10% rate of tax should apply to the gains and profits arising from the non-telecommunications business activities. But to begin my last topic, I announced a tax amnesty for 6 months to allow people who have failed to declare their taxable income in past years to rationalize their tax affairs before being caught out. Bearing in mind the transparency and information sharing internationally, this is what the board has found out to do with other states. Individuals were given an option to repatriate money held abroad before the product of income accrued and derived from Gibraltar or which are remitted to Gibraltar with otherwise taxable statement, to hold the state clean on a payment of a 5% tax with the total amount remitted to Gibraltar and deposited here. Any individual who fails to avail himself of this tax amnesty in respect of the Commissioner of Income Tax, subject to the fine, any such undeclared money will be subject to a penalty charge of 100% of the tax that would have been due if the income accrued and derived from Gibraltar had been properly declared at the time. The total taxable income declared and repatriated as a result of the amnesty was £27.78 million, Mr. Speaker. In terms of benefits to government costs, the total tax collected was £1.39 million. The Speaker of the Government has now decided to extend the tax amnesty for a further period of 6 months, although on not such favourable terms, and effective from midnight tonight, the rates will be applied. Will not be as a the tax amnesty will apply upon the payment to the Commissioner of Income Tax on the same terms of 7.5% of the total amount remitted to Gibraltar and deposited here, or 7.5% of the value of any assets purchased abroad from the proceeds of the income accrued and derived from Gibraltar on which tax should have been paid. The Speaker, old age pensions will increase this year in line with the rate of inflation, so that the single rate for old age pensions will increase from £438.78 to £440.64, and the coupled rate will increase from £638.22 to £660.85. At the same time, the cash deferred pension will be maintained with the minimum income guarantee. Mr. Speaker, in line with our manifesto commitment, the general level of
public sector pay will rise by 2.75% with effect from the 1st of August 2016, with an additional 0.25% being payable to officers of the Royal Gibraltar Police, Customs, the Prison Service, the Gibraltar Fire Service, the Airport Fire Service, and Border and Coast Guard Agency, and the Ambulance Service. This is in line with the government's commitment to keep the national minimum wage under constant review and to increase this at least by the rate of inflation over our term of office, but whilst mindful of the need to keep the world competitive, the specialty minimum wage will increase from 6.25 to 6.28 per hour with effect from the 1st of August 2016. This represents an increase of around 0.5%, which is above, just above, the rate of inflation. As a figure, we have commenced the approach to the consultation with the United Union and Federation of Small Business and Assembly of Commerce in respect of the potential introduction into Gibraltar of pensions in the private sector. Given the Brexit decision, we will not be progressing this process in this financial year, whilst we observe the effects on the economy of the result of the vote that is increasing. Mr. Speaker, having finished the list of budget measures for this year, on a point of simple housekeeping, honourable members will know that it is customary as a matter of courtesy for the Chief Minister to stay in the chamber throughout the budget debate to hear all contributions. In parliamentary terms, we're in fact debating a bill without moving in matter of the Minister for Public Finance. For that reason, I hear all contributions as I am the one with the right to reply to the end for the government. This year, unusually, I will not be able to remain throughout the debate as I may need to take session calls at times to complete. As a result, I would ask members, all of them, tend to have written speeches, to please excuse me if I am unable to remain in the chamber to hear their contributions. I will endeavour to do so in order to reply to their speeches as directly as possible, but it may just not be acceptable. If they could send me a copy of their written speeches as they send them to the media, I would be grateful. Mr. Speaker, as we go forward with you, it is clear that now is the time to make the most of Gibraltar's two greatest assets, its land and its people. It is also time, of course, to pause and reflect, but it is not a time to stop all government spending or stop all government investment, as to do so would undoubtedly just halt all growth and plunge it into the second. We must continue investing in efficient and socially sensitive public services, and we must continue to strive to make Gibraltar a more attractive place to live in and to do business in. But we must also be alive to the need to cut spending further if the effects of the Brexit vote become markedly more negative in months to come. We will constantly review all of the indicators to ensure that our economy continues to perform in a manner that enables us to deliver the growth that we believe is achievable and the spending that is affordable. And the fact is that Gibraltar, despite the jolt of the 23rd of June in the morning, remains a hugely attractive and affordable place to do business. The rule of law and the common law combined make us attractive, as does our fiscal competitiveness, and after today, our very attractive regime for startups. The reservoir of resilience and skills, which is evident in Gibraltar today, is also a huge asset in establishing the ecosystem for business success. But our near-term challenges cannot just be whisked away, Mr. Speaker. The fact is that we have as many reasons to be happy about last year as we have to be cautious about the coming 24 to 36 months. The absence of clear political direction in London is not insignificant to us, as it is not for the rest of Europe either. It is our medium-term challenges that we can influence with hard work and determination. And our long-term challenges are also the opportunity for us to shape and fashion the future into the form we wish by the work we do now, by how persuasive our cases, and by how unified our approach remains. We owe it to our grandparents and parents who fought so hard to achieve what they have secured in the European Union until the 23rd of June. And we will fight to retain in as great a measure as possible all that they have achieved for our children and for our grandchildren. Mr. Speaker, I am not one to rely on the quotes of others in speeches, but these are time to think of and take inspiration from the things said before by those facing adversity. Kennedy's famous "Think not of what your country can do for you, but of what you can do for your country," is, I am sure, on the minds of many, especially those who have spontaneously gotten in touch with me, with other ministerial colleagues, and with the government generally, to reach out to help at this time in our history. I would, however, wish to share with you the quote from Henry Ford, which reminds us that when everything seems to be going against you, remember that the aeroplane takes off against the wind much with it. Mr. Speaker, as the dawn of the 23rd of June becomes a more and more distant memory, we can see that there is a lot that we can achieve going forward. What is clear, Mr. Speaker, is that this is not a time for ego. It is not a time for grandstanding or for taking Gibraltar, talking Gibraltar down. It is not a time for electioneering or for the spin of party politics. This is a time for action, for hard work and hard thinking, for prudence and for preparation. And that is what this government is about. That is what we have been preparing for. That is what this budget does. Our prudence to date has paid off. Our public finances are strong and resilient. We have the liquidity necessary to deal with the issues that do confront us, and we have the liquidity necessary to deal with the issues that could confront us. We have the sovereign wealth of the rainy day funds that we need in the funds that we have established and grown. This is a time, Mr. Speaker, yes, to pause and reflect, but also a time to remain confident, to deliver on our public commitments, and to be tempered by the prudence that the moment requires. The fundamentals of the Gibraltar economy are strong. In fact, Mr. Speaker, the fundamentals of the Gibraltar economy are stronger than ever. And undermining confidence in Gibraltar, in our national financial institutions, and in the fundamentals of our economy would be unhelpful and wrong. And I am sure that there will not be anyone in Gibraltar who would today seek to do that, given the situation in which we find ourselves. Mr. Speaker, this is the time in our history for extraordinary people in our community to do extraordinary things for our nation. Let us have the confidence to work together in this house and beyond to fulfill the ambitions of our nation and to use the community's talent to the full. Mr. Speaker, for all of those reasons, I commend the bill to you.
So who did cost the time when we normally recess for lunch? What would this be? So we recess now on the turn of 2:15.
Only to see that the custom in the economy, so we could be able to continue to fly with it.
I don't have to invite honourable members to participate in the debate on general principles of this bill, since I already have the order in which members are going to participate in this debate. Therefore, call from the honourable
member. I'm very grateful, Mr. Speaker. I'm very grateful for the courtesy that the honourable speaker wanted to extend the entirety of the House, but I am, for my part, prepared to apply to the Chief Minister now. Mr. Speaker, it's an honour for me to deliver to this House my fourth budget speech as leader of the opposition and my ninth budget speech overall. Unhappily, Mr. Speaker, this year we find ourselves debating these estimates of revenue and expenditure against the backdrop of a Brexit vote at the referendum and potentially the single largest threat to our economic model since the closure of the frontier and, in my view, in the history of democratic government in Gibraltar. While on this side of the House, we have every faith in the ability of our community to overcome adversity, it is important that this debate takes place within a framework of sober analysis, prudence, and realism. We are, after all, debating what the government, for example, has spent and what it intends to spend, the way the government intends to fund that spending, the size of our reserves and public debt today and also into the future. That debate must also, above all, take place in the context of a probable Brexit and the uncertainties that Gibraltar currently faces. No one wants, Mr. Speaker, the United Kingdom to leave the EU, but our economic contingency plans must proceed on the basis that Brexit is not only possible, but that is indeed probable. Our economic model is one that is based largely on the ability of commercial entities to transport their goods and services into the European Union. It is a model that we have spent many decades developing and selling to customers. It is a model that we must do everything that we can to protect. And indeed, Mr. Speaker, in this context, I remind the House that both the Chief Minister and myself, during the course of the referendum debate, were both of the view
that a vote to Brexit the European Union was a vote that placed an existential threat over that model that we have relied upon for the last 3 decades. The financial services sector that is built on those foundations provides over 4,643 jobs on the last figures that we have. And in this context, I'm very grateful to the Honourable the Minister for Employment to have provided me with an advanced copy of the employment survey. The tourist sector, that also benefits from free movement of people, provides many thousands of jobs. The hotel and restaurant sector alone account for 1,763 jobs. Nearly 2 million people visited Gibraltar last year to our EU borders. Over many decades, we have poured investment in Gibraltar by emphasizing an attractive lifestyle, a job and a home in Gibraltar, a second home or easy access to Spain. The gambling and betting activity sector, where those are real factors, employs 3,205 people. Behind those numbers, of course, there are real people and real families, and it's for the sake of those real people and those real families that we must ensure that no stone is left unturned in our attempt to protect them in this situation. And of course, Mr. Speaker, each sector of the economy is not hermetically sealed from the next. The success of the private rental and home ownership sector is directly linked to the success of, amongst others, the financial services and the gaming sector. The ability of the government through tax revenue to continue to provide year-on-year increases in health and in our caring services is also dependent on those jobs. Less jobs, less revenue, less expenditure. It's a simple formula, Mr. Speaker. In May 2012, our expenditure on health was £75 million. £75 million. In this budget, expenditure on health has increased this year, according to the forecast outturn, to £107.2 million. That represents an increase, Mr. Speaker, of 43% over the last 4 years. Everyone wants the best possible health and caring services. But to do that, we must continue to prosper as we have done over the last 3 decades. When I make that analysis of jobs, expenditure, and revenue, I'm also mindful of the fact that at a macroeconomic level, half of our GDP is accounted for by jobs in our economy. At the end of March 2015, there were 26,144 jobs in the economy, a rise of 7.1% since March 2014. Much of that rise is in construction, but it feeds directly and indirectly into economic growth, and therefore, the Honourable, the Father of the House, is right to be cautious in terms of GDP projections in the uncertain world that we live post the Brexit referendum. Gibraltar's size and ability and agility, I beg your pardon, makes us able to react to events quickly. And that is a huge advantage at this time. But our dependence on certain sectors, and in particular economic model, together with growth based on public spending, may make us significantly susceptible to a downturn. It's one of the reasons the Honourable Gentleman and I, indeed, were concerned about a possible Brexit vote. And that is why, Mr. Speaker, for all my criticisms of the government about spending and public debt over the last 4 years, it's my duty to steer a careful line between honest assessment in the public interest with a need to maintain confidence and to work with the government in order to attempt to steer Gibraltar into calmer waters. To do otherwise would constitute a dereliction of duty, and it's not what I'm in politics for. A quid pro quo, however, has to be
that those dealings with the government must be based on an open, transparent, and non-partisan basis, where initiatives on the future of Gibraltar are not made unilaterally by the government. Future generations of Gibraltarians will not forgive the Honourable Gentleman, as indeed will not forgive me, if we were to place party before country in this situation. It is therefore a difficult budget speech that I deliver today, balancing as I must objective observation of the state of public finances, which is my principal duty after all to this House, against a very difficult backdrop indeed. We cannot, however, divorce this debate from reality. Mr. Speaker, in my view, our focus as a nation has to be retention of confidence in the market in Gibraltar and retention of existing clients. Early public assurances from the United Kingdom government that it will be immovable in ensuring Gibraltar's access to the single market must be the priority goal. Even this, I accept, is easier said than done, but it must still be a priority. The proponents of the Leave campaign hold different views about UK access to the single market. The announcement that there is to be significant internal reflection and discussion in the United Kingdom to decide some of these issues before any notice is provided to the Council of Europe under Article 50 is to be welcomed. That will give us time to express our views and to lobby intensely. Lobbying that I would expect will be undertaken on a joint basis between the government and the opposition. If an Article 50 notice can be avoided by the United Kingdom staying a member of the EU and England and Wales opting out in a Denmark-Greenland type situation, all the better. I can, of course, foresee constitutional and significant political problems with the latter, but we must accept that the government is entitled to leave no stone unturned in this situation. There are other options, Mr. Speaker, that we have discussed and will remain confidential between us until the appropriate juncture. In my view, however, we must plan on the basis that at some stage an Article 50 notice will be delivered by the UK government to the European Council. We therefore have to be prepared for that eventuality. That notice, Mr. Speaker, will trigger a 2-year negotiating period where the UK will negotiate terms of exit with the EU, including any access to the single market. We need to use all the time that we have, mobilising our friends in the United Kingdom and obtaining assurances from the political protagonists of the future that any access the United Kingdom obtains to the single market will be extended to Gibraltar. Mr. Speaker, in this regard, of course, the Foreign Minister of Spain, Senor García Margallo, has on a number of occasions reiterated that Spain will not agree access for the United Kingdom to the single market with the inclusion of Gibraltar. We are going, Mr. Speaker, to demonstrate to Senor García Margallo what it is to have resolve, what it is to have unity in this community, and what it is to show determination as a leader, Mr. Speaker. But it is important to emphasize that timing is all important. My understanding is that Spain has no right to veto any terms of access between the UK and other member states. What Spain can veto is an extension of the 2-year negotiating period. Provided that agreement is reached within a period of 2 years after Article 50 notice is delivered, Spain will not be able to deliver it to veto an agreement reached by the UK government with the rest of the EU, including an agreement in respect to Gibraltar. That is why, Mr. Speaker, early intervention is absolutely critical on our part. The leaders of the new campaign also spoke about the UK negotiating deals with third parties. At the moment, the EU has 50 such trade deals with third parties. Those and any other trade deals should be extended to Gibraltar as and when they are negotiated by the United Kingdom. Our gaming and insurance sectors have also faced recent challenges arising from decisions taken by the UK government. Changes to the VAT regime, the point of consumption tax, are some of those challenges. In the situation that we find ourselves today, caused entirely by the UK government decision to hold a referendum, the UK government has to rethink these policies as they affect the water. And in this respect, Mr. Speaker, I therefore look forward to the speech that the Honourable Gentleman, the Minister for Financial Services, Mr. Isola, will be delivering in due course. And in my opinion, Mr. Speaker, in tandem with all that, we need to work very closely with stakeholders, opening or expanding into areas that are less susceptible to EU challenges that we face. These are some, Mr. Speaker, areas that we need to focus, in my opinion, but undoubtedly there are others. Mr. Speaker, many of the Chief Minister said last week that it was business as usual. The very fact that we are holding this budget debate today shows that as far as government and opposition and the respective roles that we have been elected by this community to perform, it is business as usual. But the Chief Minister also said that it was business as usual in terms of the government's adherence to its manifesto commitment. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman cannot, in my respectful view, run with the hare and hunt with the hound. Yesterday, in giving a concept of the budget measures that he was proposing to introduce or hoping to introduce at the session, he said that the government had to rein in on spending. Mr. Speaker, I couldn't agree more with that statement. However, there is absolutely nothing that we have said today that indicates to me that the government is serious about its intention to rein in on spending. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, he has said nothing at all about how much money the government intends to raise through some of the measures that he is proposing to introduce today, or has outlined of today, and has not indicated to his house, as would have been usual, particularly in the situation that we find ourselves at today, how much some of the measures that he is proposing to introduce will cost the government in the years and in the year that is going to follow, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman has said during the course of his intervention that he is proud of the government spending. Mr. Speaker, of course a government is going to be proud of its spending. But spending per se is neither here nor there. It's about priorities in spending, Mr. Speaker. And it's also long-term consequences of that spending. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman and I are not going to be judged by future generations on the moment. We're not going to be judged on this budget. We're not going to be judged for how loudly the Honourable Gentleman offers to bang on the table every time the Honourable Gentleman makes a good point, or indeed bang on the table the gentleman on this side of the house. Bang on the table, hopefully, when I finish my speech, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman and I will be judged by future generations on consequence about firing and increases in the current expenditure, as I will develop in due course, consequences about carrying the debt that we are currently carrying. And there is nothing, Mr. Speaker, that the Honourable Gentleman has said in his budget address that certainly allays my concerns, as it indicates to me that the Honourable Gentleman's mindset has changed, particularly in the light of that probable Brexit. In the United Kingdom, Mr. Speaker, we have already seen how its credit rating has been downgraded, and there has been huge market volatility and uncertainty. The Chancellor of the Exchequer, Gordon Osborne, made a robust optimistic and positive speech at the Treasury last Monday, emphasizing that Britain has one of the strongest major advanced economies in the world, and that as a result, the British economy was about as strong as it could be to confront the challenges Britain now faced. The very next day, in an interview with the BBC, he said that the UK government had to show it could live within its means, and that tax rises and spending cuts were almost inevitable. Last week, the Honourable the Father of the House said that this was that Brexit was potentially the most serious crisis to hit the world since the 1930s. I certainly agree with him as far as the seriousness of the potential crisis to Gibraltar. In the context of a probable Brexit and the uncertainty that we will face over the next 2 years, the government cannot expect to continue spending money at the rate that it has been spending, and it cannot be business as usual as far as their manifesto commitments are concerned. Their manifesto, Mr. Speaker, will cost the taxpayer hundreds of millions of pounds in the context of the fact that they have already spent £750 million in capital projects over the last 4 years, Mr. Speaker. Our discourse over those years has been that the government was spending too much money, funded by too much debt, part of which was being kept away from proper parliamentary scrutiny in government-owned companies. But we will also say that that was not only imprudent at the best of times, but less so when there were potentially difficult times ahead for Gibraltar. In my 2014 speech that I delivered to the Chamber of Commerce on the budget that the Honourable Gentleman had just recently then delivered, I identified and listed a potential Brexit as one of the potential pairs up ahead for this community. And quite frankly, Mr. Speaker, it is something that the government ought to have been factoring into the equation of its public spending, both in terms of the current expenditure and also expenditure on capital projects over the last 4 years. Because however improbable we all thought that a Brexit was likely to be, it was nonetheless possible. And to have spent money, Mr. Speaker, in the way that the government has spent money over the last 4 years is not, in our view, prudent or reasonable. And there is nothing, Mr. Speaker, absolutely nothing unpatriotic about my criticisms of the government in this respect. I am no less of a Gibraltarian as the Honourable Gentleman is, simply, Mr. Speaker, because I have, on this side of the House, we all hold a different view, Mr. Speaker, about how Gibraltar can be kept safe and secure in the light of the challenges that this community faces, Mr. Speaker. But I will say this. I agree with the Honourable Gentleman that if there is ever a time for a return to the rainy day fund policy of the early 1990s, it is today. And I would hope, Mr. Speaker, over the next year, and indeed in years to come, that the honourable gentleman opposite pay much more attention to the honourable, the father of the house, and his voice of caution, and his voice of caution than they have obviously done over the last 4 years. And Mr. Speaker, there is no point, and I heard the Honourable Gentleman say, no sound get out. If I do get it, Mr. Speaker, I do get it. And if I don't agree with the Honourable Gentleman that the money community care is a rainy day fund for the entirety of the community, and it is self-evident, Mr. Speaker, that it is not so. Because the money community care, which is a money owned by a charity of Gibraltar for the benefit of a sector of our community, is not money that is going to be available, Mr. Speaker, for the government and for the general community, those things were not to go as well as we all hope that it's going to be going over the next 4 years. But you see that, and I want to illustrate some of these issues by reference to increases in the current expenditure compared to the current revenue together with decreases in cash reserves. Because on the 31st of March 2012, the overall recurrent departmental expenditure stood at £332.7 million, whereas the forecast outflow this year stands at £453.1 million. In other words, it is driven just simply on the estimate of revenue and expenditure which we are debating by 36.1% since March 2012. That is a very significant increase in 4 years, and it still underestimates increases in recurrent expenditure for reasons that I'm going to be developing in a moment. Next year, it is expected to rise by 40% from the position it was in March 2012 to £461.1 million. But you see that in itself does not provide us, as I alluded to a few moments ago, with a full picture. As I have noted in previous years, the comparison between March 2012 and March 2016 is not comparing like with like. Prior to financial year ending March 2014, contributions to community care were treated as an expense through a contribution to the Social Security Fund. Since 2014, these amounts have not been treated as an expense and have been included in the surplus, and then from there it has been paid to community care. In other words, Mr. Speaker, prior to 2014, the contributions to community care were treated as an expense above the line. Subsequent to 2014, it's been treated as an expense below the line. The effect in accounting terms is to lower expenditure and to increase the surplus by a corresponding amount. This year, that would have meant an increase in the current expenditure of £20 million and a decrease in the surplus by that amount. If you compare like with like, the current departmental expenditure based on these estimates that we're debating today have increased by 42.2% since 2012. But, Mr. Speaker, none of this, of course, takes into account the huge elephant in the room. That is, Credit Finance Company Limited and the Gibraltar Investment Holdings Limited. Because there is absolutely no point, Mr. Speaker, to talk and to back ourselves in the back about a surplus of £38.8 million when the government is calling for the Gibraltar Savings Bank to invest £400 million in Credit Finance Company Limited, and that company is then spending tens of millions of pounds on payment, for example, of the commuted pensions of civil servants, Mr. Speaker. The commuted pensions of civil servants have traditionally been an expense of the government, and now it is an expense of Credit Finance Company Limited. The effect, and it doesn't take a rocket scientist to work this out, is that, of course, the government does not have to pay that money directly itself to pay for the community pension of civil service, which is a very good idea, Mr. Speaker. I'm not criticizing it. But it doesn't, but Mr. Speaker, the government does not pay for it itself. It's paid for by Credit Finance Company Limited, meaning that the government has more money in these estimates of revenue and expenditure available to it. But Mr. Speaker, more than £300 million from Credit Finance Company Limited have also been paid to Gibraltar Investment Holdings Limited, which is the company at the top of the pyramid of all government-owned companies, and that money is seeping down through government-owned companies, and it's being used to quote the Honourable the Father of the House, who, in fairness to him, has always been straight with this House in relation to this particular issue, to fund the cash flow requirements of
of those government-owned companies, Mr. Speaker. So Mr. Speaker, when the Honourable Gentleman, for example, as he did today, speaks about the change in accounting practice and the fact that the government is now funding government-owned companies to a tune of £25 million, what he doesn't say to this House, or what he doesn't accept, Mr. Speaker, is the fact that Gibraltar Investment Holdings Limited is receiving hundreds of millions of pounds of favoured money, which it is then using in order to fund those government-owned companies. If that happens to credit finance, Mr. Speaker, then of course the government does not have to itself put its money in its pocket and use the money that it set out in its estimates of revenue and expenditure. And again, Mr. Speaker, it distorts expenditure of the government by creating a picture that is, of course, healthier, Mr. Speaker, than in reality it is. Because every debt, let's call it whether we call it investment or we call it anything else, has to, at some stage, be repaired, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, in my view, with or without the expenditure by Credit Finance Company Limited, these are very significant increases in recurrent expenditure, and I remain as concerned today as I have been over the last few years. More so, of course, in the climate that we find ourselves in. When we compare this long-term trend of increasing recurrent expenditure with long-term trends of increasing recurrent revenue, debt, and decreasing cash reserves, we can see that concern is entirely justified. In March 2012, the current revenue, I beg your pardon, stood at £454 million. The current departmental expenditure, as you have seen, is £332.7 million. The current departmental revenue therefore stood at 73.2% of the current expenditure. Recurrent revenue today stands at £581.5 million, and the current departmental expenditure has a forecast outcome of £453.1 million. To that, we have to add the £20 million to community care, which now the government is keeping below the line when prior to 2014 it was keeping above the line. Recurrent departmental expenditure today is therefore currently running, if we are to compare like with like March 2012 to March 2016, at 81.3% of the current revenue, and that is not taken into account, Mr. Speaker. The expenditure that is not being accounted for in these estimates of revenue and expenditure, but that is being channeled through Credit Finance Company Limited with the money from the Gibraltar Savings Bank. Moreover, whilst the current departmental expenditure has increased by 42.2% since 2012, if we use my figure, or 36.1% if we use the Honourable Gentleman's figure, the current revenue has increased by 28%, Mr. Speaker. For 3 years, I have been warning about this convergence between the current revenue and the current departmental expenditure. Last year I called it a worrying trend. It is a trend that we need to reverse, more so post the referendum result. Mr. Speaker, in my analysis at the beginning of my speech, I said that segments of the economy cannot be hermetically sealed from other segments or sectors. Contraction in one sector would have a knock-on effect on others and on the size of the economy generally, and on, of course, on revenue. In this regard, input duty is actually down this year from 160 million to 151.5 million. The convergence that I have spoken about between the current revenue and expenditure would have been much narrower had it not been for an increase in revenue of 20.4 million in corporate tax and 5.5 million in personal tax. Of course, Mr. Speaker, we know from last week's answer to questions that the government owes personal taxpayers 19.5 million and also corporate taxpayers 10.1 million in tax rebates.
if that had been paid, the trend towards convergence between the current revenue and expenditure would have been much closer, and it would have, of course, virtually wiped out the surplus. Mr. Speaker, making that analysis, however, I do want to congratulate the financial secretary and indeed the father of the house. Leaving aside Credit Finance Company Limited, and as I have said, it's a massive, massive elephant in the room because it distorts much of what the government is spending in a downward trend. In the year ending 2014, the government had overspent by £40 million. Last year, it was overspent by nearly £28 million. This year, Mr. Speaker, it is not overspent, and I am happy to recognize that fact, and as I have said, congratulate the father of the house and also the financial secretary in this regard. I would also like to think, I know that there is a look of shock on the face of Mr. Speaker of the owner of the father of the house, but I would like to think that our job as an opposition in holding the government to account in this area has played a small but perhaps effective role in pushing the government into achieving that particular target. Mr. Speaker, the current expenditure is not the entirety of the government's expenditure, of course. It does not take into account capital projects, that £750 million that we say they spent over the last 4 years. The government would say that this is money well spent, investment, as they would call it, but it's money spent nonetheless. And we can see the effect of that spending and that rise in the current expenditure that I have outlined during the course of my speech on debt and also on cash reserves. On the 31st of March 2011, cash reserves stood at £273.8 million. On the 31st of March 2012, cash reserves, and that's the first budget the Honourable Gentleman delivered before the House, cash reserves had dropped, but still stood at a very healthy £213.9 million. From then on, cash reserves have dropped significantly to £73.2 million last year in March 2015, and the forecast outcome for this year is £100.3 million. Mr. Speaker, that represents a downturn in the cash reserves available to this government and this community of 63% since March of 2012, Mr. Speaker. The increase in the current expenditure and capital expenditure over the last 4 year term also explains why direct and indirect public debt has increased exponentially since the Honourable Gentleman opposite came into office. In March 2011, net debt stood at £206.36 million. By March 2012, it had increased to £303.72 million. And by the end of December last year, it stood at £418 million, Mr. Speaker. That is less than £30 million from the then legal borrowing limit of £447 million. Today, it said the forecast outcome net debt stands at £345 million. That level is still, Mr. Speaker, higher than the government's target at the election of £314 million for this year. And I expect, Mr. Speaker, that net debt is going to continue to increase substantially over the next year and over the next few years. Indeed, just as at the beginning of last year, before last year's budget session, net debt stood in December of at £400 million and above, it was reduced for the purposes of the budget debate, but started to increase very rapidly thereafter. So too will we see the same pattern this year. And the reason is very simple. Every year before the budget debate, there is a tightening of the belt. Less bills are paid during the period, producing a temporary increase
and cast his vote. After the budget, there is a weakening of the vote, cash reserves decrease, and net debt then suddenly starts increasing. We do not have the figures for April and May, because the Honourable the Father of the House last year told us that he was not providing those figures because it would feature in the speech that was going to be delivered by the Honourable the Chief Minister. Unfortunately, Mr. Speaker, just as we predicted last week, that has not been the case, but I know, Mr. Speaker, as well as the Honourable Father of the House, that net debt and the trend in net debt is only going in one direction, unfortunately, and that is upwards. Mr. Speaker, the long-term trend is clear. Very significant increases in the current expenditure over the last 4 years, your current revenue increasing at a slower rate than expenditure in percentage terms, very significant reductions in reserves, and very significant increases in net debt. And of course, that does not take into account of the elephant in the room, Credit Finance Company Limited. This, of course, Mr. Speaker, posed an insoluble problem for the government over the last 4 years. Not only had it promised £750 million of capital credit to the electors in 2011, but it was also promised, which is delivering, to donate all surpluses to community care and had criticised the level of debt under the DSD government as an addiction to debt. And of course, because of the legal borrowing limit at the time, it was also legally impossible for the government to directly borrow sufficient money in order to pay for all those promises that it made in 2011. That is the reason why, Mr. Speaker, in our view, £400 million of debentures from the Gibraltar Savings Bank was, to use their term, invested in Credit Finance Company Limited, which in turn, as I have alluded to during the course of my speech, is being used in order to pay for government expenditure. The gross debt of this community is not £446 million in the forecast outcome. It is £486 million if you simply take into account the money invested in Credit Finance Company Limited, or £885 million if the government has to make good all the so-called investments made by the Gibraltar Savings Bank in government-owned companies. Prudent management, Mr. Speaker, of our public finances needs to take account of this global picture. We cannot collectively, Mr. Speaker, bury our heads in the sand and pretend that Credit Finance Company Limited does not exist and pretend that the government is not using it in order to pay for government expenditure. Mr. Speaker, many countries in Europe calculate and compute public debt by taking into account purifier arrangements and indeed the debt of government owned companies. That is the position in the United Kingdom, and that is the position that we are urging from this side of the House for the government to adopt. And Mr. Speaker, it's not just about openness and transparency or the quality of our democracy. It's also about the ability of the opposition to identify potential financial problems if they arise. And this is even more important, Mr. Speaker, this year than it was last year, Mr. Speaker. None of this, of course, takes into account the way that the government is going to be funding the power station, or indeed the money that the government is now going to be expending in relation to the tunnel under the runway. And we reserve our judgment until we look at the detail of that to see what effect it might have on the public finances, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, this year, the government changed the way the legal borrowing limits were calculated, and there was a sense of deja vu, Mr. Speaker, in the way that the government did it. During the 2011 election, the Honourable Gentleman opposite said nothing about their plan to use the Gibraltar Savings Bank in order to fund government expenditure and therefore, directly or indirectly, their manifesto commitment. In March 2012, barely 3 months after the 2011 election, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable the Chief Minister came to this House with a bill amending the Gibraltar Savings Bank in order to do away with the requirement that all the investments of the Gibraltar Savings Bank be made in cash or cash equivalents from the preservation of their capital value perspective. In other words, very liquid and very safe forms of investment. That change in the Gibraltar Savings Bank is what allowed the government to invest Gibraltar Savings Bank deposits in credit finance, which has allowed them in turn to pay for their expenditure. It could not have happened, Mr. Speaker, under a GOP government. During the 2015 general election, the government made promises running into hundreds of millions of pounds in their 2015 manifesto. It could not have paid for those promises by borrowing directly under the law as it stood then, which in simple terms had a net debt borrowing limit based on 80% of the current revenue. As I have already noted, net debt was running very close to the legal borrowing limit. At one point, less than £30 million from that debt, net debt calculation. Rather than just simply say to the people of Gibraltar that the GSC Liberals were planning to change the way the legal borrowing limit was calculated and therefore borrow more, which they couldn't do because of those debt limits, they said nothing and changed the formula barely 3 months into their term in office. Now, Mr. Speaker, the effect of it is that the government can borrow 40% of GDP, i.e. the size of the economy. It can borrow much more than it did before, and without being limited to 80% of the current revenue. The experiences in places like Bermuda say that the decoupling of debt from the current revenue in a small jurisdiction is not prudent, Mr. Speaker. In a post-Brexit situation, I urge even more caution. I genuinely want the Honourable Gentleman to succeed in these difficult circumstances, and I genuinely believe that we can. The alternative does not bear thinking about. But if it is to do so, it really must start a period of serious consolidation. It must roll in public debt. It must roll in future public spending. And I also urge them to move towards greater transparency of the public finances by bringing onto the books of the government its off-balance sheet debt, which is a trend in the UK and in other democratic countries. New spending, Mr. Speaker, over the next few years has to be very carefully prioritised. There are many examples, Mr. Speaker, where we believe the government has not prioritised its spending. But this year, Mr. Speaker, I want my analysis to be just as serious and sober as other years, but without the point scoring that has characterised these debates for many years. Mr. Speaker, I now turn to economic growth. Mr. Speaker, the forecast gross domestic product for the financial year 2013-14 was $1.484 billion, and the GDP for 2014-15 was $1.64 billion. Today, the Chief Minister has said that economic growth for the year ending the 31st of March 2016 is forecast to rise to $1.77 billion. These figures, Mr. Speaker, are therefore good figures, and I congratulate the government on them. But that economic growth has been driven to a large extent by government projects, construction in particular, and we would say funded by government direct and indirect borrowing. I hope that the Honourable Gentleman is right that the economy will continue to grow,
everyone in Gibraltar hope that he is right, not least all those on this side of the house. The speaker last year, I said this about the East Side development, and I quote, "In Gibraltar, fair to say, we have been here before on the East Side development. The first political government in the 1990s came very close to concluding a deal, and in 2005, the then Chief Minister Peter Caruana and the then Trade Minister Joe Holliday signed an agreement with the Rubin Brothers and Multiplex Construction Limited, Australia's largest construction company, and a leading property developer in the UK for an investment in the East Side worth over £1 billion. Unfortunately, the economic slump post 2007 prevented that project from prospering. The GOP hopes in the national interest that this latest project prospers and wishes the government every success in this regard. Anything that creates real jobs and economic development in Gibraltar will be welcomed by the GOP." End quote. Because this is not an easy project, and we accept that. But the government has made announcements in the past. It led people to believe that this was a done deal. When the father of the house revealed it was far from a done deal in a debate with my honourable friend, Mr. Clinton, at the election, we understandably asked questions publicly about it. The response from Cameron Holdings the day before the election was to say that they were, quote, surprised and disappointed, end quote, by the DOD attitude, and that they were happy to confirm that they were finalising arrangements for the payment of the premium in respect of this development. We were, of course, merely reacting to the father of the house and what he had said during the course of the debate. Today, we do not know whether this project is going to go ahead with this developer or with a different developer, and I believe, in the light of past public statements by the Honourable the Chief Minister and the government, we are entitled to know. Again, I hope the government succeeds in its endeavours in this regard. Mr. Speaker, in the final analysis, I believe that what we need is for the government to rethink its spending plans for the next few years in the light of the referendum vote. It is time for consolidation and long-term planning. Mr. Speaker, that in itself is nothing new, because we have been calling from this side of the house for consolidation and for the reining in of public spending for a number of years now. But it seems incumbent on a government that professes to be reasonable and a government that professes to be prudent in the light of the potential consequences that I have outlined for our economic model of a Brexit from the EU, to make that prudent and make that reasonableness a reality. And in this context, I want to say this. The Honourable Gentleman said that he is proud of government spending. I am proud, Mr. Speaker, of the work that Her Majesty's government, Her Majesty's opposition has done over the last 3 years in continually highlighting how the government was spending too much money and how our debt was increasing to a level that we believe, Mr. Speaker, was not prudent. Mr. Speaker, it is always easier to defend free spending which keeps an awful lot of people happy than to take the country view in the public interest, which is that for the sake of our future generations and our children and our children's children, that we ought to be taking a different view, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, at times, over the last 3 years, I have felt like the man who wanted to kill Father Christmas, Mr. Speaker. That was the nature of the Honourable Gentleman's largesse to the community at large. That is his own largesse, Mr. Speaker. It is a ladder that at some stage is going to have to be repaid, and in the current climate, I renew my cause, and I know that the Honourable the Father of the House will never agree with me publicly, but I hope will be making not to say in points privately in cabinet that we really do need to rethink our spending over the next 4 years. It is a time for us all to reflect. I have been talking about the culture of entitlement and expectations of voter, which I felt we all collectively needed to tackle. How many of us in this chamber, Mr. Speaker, who have been government ministers, as I have been, have come across a situation where someone, in good faith, because it has to be said that people come to you in good faith, but they come to you and they say, I am asking you to please do X, Y, and Z for me, not because I'm asking you to do a favor for me, but because I am entitled to it. I mean it as nothing. Mr. Speaker, in the current climate, there is something more important than ourselves as individuals. There is a collective well-being of this community and the obligation to ensure that future generations enjoy the benefits that we have enjoyed. To do that, we must all be responsible in the demands that we impose on the state, particularly over the next couple of years. As I said, a rethink of spending priorities is important. A rainbow fund is, in our view, desirable. I do not agree with the Honourable Gentleman that that is what the Honourable Gentleman opposite has put into operation. Consolidation means, of course, completion, for example, of works of Blackwood, Laguna, and Moorish Castle, and priority projects. But it also means a pause on substantial increases in spending, in particular the current expenditure and debt, until we have a clearer picture of what the future holds. And it also means, Mr. Speaker, as my honourable friend, the honourable Mr. Clinton, will outline in the course of his speech, a realistic programme for repayment of that very significant direct and indirect debt that is owed by this community. The honourable gentleman finds himself feeling a ship in waters and weather that might seem calm for now, but which have the propensity to develop into the perfect storm. He can rely on me to help in any way that I can, but we cannot proceed on the basis of manifesto promises that were made pre-referendum, Mr. Speaker. The rules of the game have changed, and it is now time, Mr. Speaker, for no further gambles, Mr. Speaker. And before I sit down, I too, Mr. Speaker, want to thank the job that the Honourable Clerk of the House has done, not only as a team, not only during the course of the referendum, but during the course of the last year. I want to thank Mr. Speaker as well for the patience in listening to what at times are, of course, heated debates across the floor of this House. I also want to add my voice to the Honourable, the Chief Minister's voice, in thanking Mr. Frank Carreras for the absolutely excellent work that he has done and for the service that he has rendered Gibraltar over the many, many years that he has served this community. Mr. Speaker, thank you very much.
Mr. Speaker, in order to allow me to have a conversation as quickly as possible with Father Christmas, the security detail, I propose that the House should now adjourn until 4 p.m.
The House will now adjourn until 4 p.m.